Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Bring it back to Durant and this injury and stuff like that. One of the things that I've noticed is Durant, in terms of the injury, you know, going out there, obviously playing hurt and re-injuring it, he is sticking to the story, or he's saying, hey, I made the decision. I made it because, you know, I wanted to win with my brothers. I knew the risk I was taking, but it was worth it. And then a lot of people are you know, applauding him for that. Like, yeah, that's what it's all about. You know, winning for your team, that's the best, character quality you could have. You know, so he's taking ownership of it. I would, you know, basically saying I would do it again.
He was taking a lot of criticism.
Before that, but yeah. Now.
No, I mean, people were saying, that he was pressured, almost like
right.
He's this kind of dumb job.
But he's saying no. Is that a good message?
Well, no. I mean, here's the thing. I mean, I think that the Warriors, I fault the Warriors. What they did with Klay Thompson, remember the first time they said, no, you're not playing when he got the hamstring?
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to play and all that. They said, you ain't playing because, you know what occurs there? I'd feel terrible.
It was also 1-1.
Yeah.
They weren't down.
That's right. All that figures into it, right?
Right.
I'd feel terrible if he would have gone and got hurt. The Warriors, and think of us as parents. And again, that's why you have people, adults, or defensive coordinators sit up in the press box,
mm-hmm.
high above the fray, because when you're in the middle of the thing, you can't see it.
That's why
you've got to have adults in the room who can see the perspective.
Mm-hmm.
The adults in Golden State said, listen, you know, you got this calf thing. You've already been hurt. You've mm-hmm. already had a fractured foot. You had that. You got hurt against Houston. You know, you got this thing out here. No, shut it down.
You just dodged mm-hmm. a bullet.
Yeah, just
we
shut
all thought
it
was Achilles
down.
The first time.
Okay. I thought that. Let's I live. Think it's
let's live.
Torn,
we're going to a new arena, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, if we lose, we lose. We're doing it. They should have shut him down. Don't leave it up. Like, you know, you're a musician. You want to play.
Mm-hmm.
You know. You have got to, as adults, Lisa said, Kevin, shut it down.
So you take all responsibility away from Kevin?
No, I'm saying you got to protect Kevin from himself.
Because mm-hmm.
like he said, yeah, he's going to sit up in a hospital. I want to play. So it's kind of like, yeah, that's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm saying, I know you want to play, but I want you to be able to play next year and the year after that. And if you go down if you tear your calf muscle, or heaven forbid, you tear your Achilles, you know, you don't have a career, we don't have you, and it's tough. So we're going to shut you down.
Do you think the fact that, you know, all the talk was he's not going to be with you next year anyway,
well,
do you
see,
think that that came?
That could almost be a reverse kind of the kind of, we're going to fuck you.
Well, you don't have to be.
We're going to send you out there. You ain't going to be. You're not going to be out there anyway. So, you know, yeah, you're not going to be with us anyway. So, yeah, Negro. Right. Go out. I mean, I'm not. They didn't say that, but it's kind of like the mentality. Shit, you ain't gonna be with us anyway. But you turn into like, because you heard the. Well, maybe he can go every day. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe he go. And there's this pressure, mm-hmm. and you're this competitor out there, as a poet, you know, it's almost, you're right, Jamal. I mean, you didn't, but it could be that kind of inferred thing. Well, shit, just you leaving us. Now, like we joked in the front of the show, now he's begging. I mean, mm-hmm. now, well, Master, can I come back home? Yeah. No, you wanted to leave, but all right. Here, sleep in the back. We got a room there. Hey, well, can I have my own room? No. You know, we already gave that room away.
Right.
You know, somebody else is sleeping. Who? Kawhi.
But
Kawhi's sleeping there. But you can sleep in the room next door to that. But ain't got no air conditioning. if he had the mentality, and again, everybody's different.
He's a martyr.
But if he had the mentality of a Kawhi Leonard, he'd known that already. And that's why it's so important to know yourself.
Right.
Because if he would have known that already, he wouldn't have had to prove anything.
Mm-hmm.
He would have known, hey, I'm the closer.
Mm-hmm.
You ain't got to, I'm Kevin Durant. You ain't got to tell me.
You know who I am.
You know, as he said later, but I don't think he's really still believed.
He believes that. He says it, but doesn't.
He doesn't believe it.
If he knew. It just came recently. He just said that recently.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And maybe now sitting up in the, maybe it comes in and says, you know what? All along, and I'm not, because we all at some point feel like that when Rich says, wait a minute, man, I'm the guy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm not, you know, but you have to know yourself. You have to know your value. And I think particularly, you know, if you're an African American in this particular society, if Kevin Durant were white, and I mean, I'm saying this same Kevin Durant, 7-1, shooting just great, because usually they made out
of Nowitzki. Say if he's Nowitzki.
Times 112.
Mm-hmm.
Nowitzki times a million. He'd be the president of the United States. He'd be the president of the United States, right? And he wouldn't have to have this doubt. But I think as black people, and I'm not even just talking about basketball. In general, if you're at the New York Times, whatever, there's always, I ran into somebody who just recently won a Pulitzer. And, you know, the conversation was almost like, but people are still kind of hating me or whatever. It's like this doubt or quilts not getting the same validation that that'd be like Bird. I think guy like Bird. I think anybody great black person, great in the society, you're not getting that validation from the larger white society. That's because that's not what we are supposed to do. Black people are not supposed to be geniuses and legends and all that. You know, so I think that with Durant, he never got that kind of reinforcement, knowing that I ain't got to go out there and rip my Achilles to prove that. I know who, I'm the man. I the reason you guys won three more, like you said, was because of me.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's just, what do y'all think about that?
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot of, I think that's true. I think that is true. And I think, you know, some guys, very, very special people are able to, you know, maybe Kawhi is one of those people. Like, so some guys can do it without that validation.
Right. He weathered.
But the average person, or even, you know, even beyond the average person, most people, they need some sort of validation. They're a little, you know, tiptoeing, especially in this, like you said, in this society. I mean, that's how we're trained. You know?
Right, to doubt yourself, second guess you. I'm just hearing, you know, so Kyrie Irving just fired his agent.
Right. Yeah, Jeff Wexler.
But I'm like, listen to the commentator then to go with Roc Nation. Right. I'm listening to guys, you know, mostly white, you know, comment, you know, broad, you know, guy, as kind of, oh, how can he leave the guy? The guy, he's been, you know, he's worked so hard for him. And he, you know, but it's this underlying, and then to go to Roc Nation. How many clients does Roc Nation? But it's like this underpinning of whatever black folks say, well, we're going to go with
or Rich
other
Paul.
Black folks.
Or Anthony Davis going to Rich Paul.
Rich Paul is like,
right.
And there's this undertone. And again, it's like, you know, this undertone of like, well, and you know, when black folks help black folks, I was like, well, why do you do that?
Right.
I mean, how could you, what's wrong with you?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's real. I mean, that like you said, you want to go beyond sports. I mean,
yeah,
for sure. We talk
about
this all the time. Like you know,
your brand.
You have to have a white lawyer or white accountant.
Anything other than black.
Right. Mm-hmm. People will question you and make you question yourself.
Right.
And your own worth, your self-worth.
Right. The fact that we depend on each other. And it's a, wait a minute, people will say, wait, our whole being white people, our whole economic foundation is predicated on you all not helping each other
right.
and mm-hmm. helping us.
Right.
Right.
And it's funny how this conversation began with KD, but it's a logical thing because if he would have known that, no, man, I'm the, what is it, praise God from whom all blessings flow.
Mm-hmm.
I'm why all this is happening.
That's right.
So all these other texts about, you just join in or whatever. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, like I keep going back to you and music or whatever band. Let's say you're in, you want to join Train's band or you want to join the Duke Ellington Orchestra. Mm-hmm. They're not going to kill you. Well, damn it, why do you want to join? Mm-hmm. Why do you want to leave the, like, whatever a secondary orchestra would be, like Jay McShane or something, and go play with Duke Ellington? And I'm like, wait, are you kidding me?
Or the NBC Orchestra or something like that.
Yeah, go to the NBC Orchestra.
Oh, no, from the NBC Orchestra.
Oh, to Duke Ellington. That's actually even better. They said, well, why are you going to do that? I said, well, because Duke Ellington. Mm-hmm. But people would be killing you for that. So, and I think that the more we talk about it, you know, and I think we knew that about Durant.
Yeah. But I mean, you said it the other day. You said something that stuck in my head about the Durant issue. You know, how, you know, Durant's always been questioned like this, and they put pressure on Durant. And you said the other day, yeah, because people know it gets to him.
Yeah, right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, he exposes himself to that stuff because he makes it clear that he's influenced by it and that he's bothered by it. Right. So people will keep hitting you.
It's just like the water.
We would be taking a shower, and if you happen to have a cut or a scrape, your shower would just burn. It would burn like you were sticking your hand in acid.
Okay, well, now you got to start flushing your water for 25 minutes before you use it for anything.
There is no trust when it comes to our state government.
When it's a man-made disaster, specifically one led by elected officials, then there's a whole nother level of psychological trauma because these are people who you have put your trust in.
The state nurse told me, I understand your son has lead poisoning, but it's not as bad as it could be. He's just going to lose a few IQ points. No, that's my child. How would you feel if someone told you that about your child? How is that fair to him?
For the residents of Flint, Michigan, the fight for clean water has been a years-long nightmare. And last week, the possibility that government officials will ultimately be held accountable was temporarily put on hold. On Thursday, state prosecutors in Michigan announced that they were dropping all 8 pending criminal cases against officials involved in the Flint water crisis. The crisis goes back nearly 5 years, when a change in the city's water source led to dangerously high levels of lead in the blood of some Flint residents, including children. Scientists have also found evidence that the city's water system was to blame for a Legionnaires' disease outbreak in 2014 and 2015 that killed 12 people. In 2016, the Office of Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette started an investigation looking into the Flint water crisis. And that investigation has cost taxpayers tens of millions of dollars. But this year, a new attorney general, Dana Nessel, took office and appointed 2 new prosecutors to oversee the Flint investigation. The decision to drop the remaining charges was made public in a statement from the prosecutors, which said that in the previous investigation, quote, all available evidence was not pursued. In other words, this isn't over yet. Chia Morgan is with me to talk about all this. She's a social worker and community activist and a lifelong Flint resident. And Steve Carmody is with us. He's a reporter with Michigan Radio based in Flint. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Hello, Tanzina.
Thanks for having us.
So Chia, let's start with you. We're talking a lot about Flint and water, but you live in Flint. What's the water like today?
There's been progress, you know, since the initial onset of the crisis, but we're still in recovery. So, you know, it's just a long process and it's hit or miss because some days your water may come back one way, some days your water may come back with another testing level, you know, so it's still frustrating. That's probably the best way to describe it.
And Chia, when you heard the news that these charges were being dropped, at least for now, what was your reaction to that?
I was hoping that, you know, this is one of those instances where our trust won't be broken again. And I want to take the Solicitor General at face value and say, you know, they told us that they're dropping the charges so that they can introduce new evidence. So I'm actually hopeful, you know, the trust in state government is not that great, but I'm hoping with the new administration that brings, you know, something new, a new level of trust.
Steve, this has been going on at least since 2014, the water crisis in Flint, that is. And we know that 15 state and local officials have been charged in the investigation under the former Attorney General, Bill Schuette. What was the status of those cases, and how does that relate to the charges that are dropped most recently?
Of the 15, seven had cut plea deals with prosecutors. In exchange for cooperating with the investigation, they received little to no penalty. They pled no contest generally to misdemeanor charges. There were eight former and current government officials who were still facing criminal charges. But when the Solicitor General dismissed the charges without prejudice, they now currently don't have any criminal charges against them, though those charges or other charges could be brought back up.
And Steve, can you remind me what the concerns were about the original investigation?
The concerns centered on, you know, was the team that was brought in from the outside by the Attorney General, Bill Schuette, had they adequately fully investigated all the possible avenues that they could have during their 3 years looking into this? The current Attorney General, Dana Nessel, when she was running last year, brought that up as a concern that she had before she won the election. And once she put new people in charge, they started raising even more questions about what evidence had not been investigated. And that was something that has been a drumbeat that has been building for the last several months. So while the announcement that they were dismissing the charges did catch us a little bit by surprise, it wasn't completely unexpected because of all the concerns they had been raising for the last several months about the quality of the investigation and about the evidence that had not been looked into.
Chia, do you feel that, I mean, how do you feel about the fact that these charges might end up being refiled or potentially having more evidence the second time around? Do you feel like this is justice delayed?
I mean, it is justice delayed. There's no way to look at it, no matter how optimistic you are. However, sometimes you have to be delayed to get things done right. You know, my parents always raised me that haste makes waste. So had this new team come in and tried to build a case off of what they didn't feel in their heart would have been, you know, a win, then it's likely that all charges would have been dropped and it wouldn't have been without prejudice. So I think that, you know, money has been wasted. There is a delay, but we can't put that on this current administration. And so that's why I'm not as upset, because there is an opportunity that some of these people who are still working in state government will actually face the judgment that they really deserve.
And Chia, are there other officials that people on the ground who were in Flint would like to see charged that had not been charged in the initial round?
Absolutely. There's no way that, you know, these charges should have been brought without our former governor, Rick Snyder, being in jail. So we are super optimistic that there is something to implicate him and that charges will be filed. And I will say, you know, this team, they've been searching cell phone records and they've been doing all of that. So they are doing their due diligence to show us, you know, that they are working on this. And to echo what Steve said, we knew that this was possibly coming because Dana Nessel hit the ground saying that she was going to do everything she could to make sure that justice was served. And I also echo his sentiments that we were a little caught off guard on Friday that, hey, this is happening now, but we weren't blindsided.
Steve, what happens now? I mean, where do the prosecutors go?
Well, at this point, they have to plow through a lot more potential evidence than what the previous team had been working on. And they're under something of a growing time constraint. There is a statute of limitations for them to file on certain charges. And with the switch in the city's water system occurring in April of 2014, it really, in many cases, will give them only until the spring of next year to file new charges. So I would expect that we'll get through the summer and then maybe in the fall we'll start seeing criminal charges being filed once again. Now, who exactly will be charged and what they'll be charged with will depend on the evidence that they have available to them and what they can think they can make stick. And we may see new players being charged. We may see some of the people who had been charged not charged again. And so the severity of some of the charges, for example, the state's former state health department director had been facing involuntary manslaughter charges. We'll see if the new team will move forward with those charges again or if they'll go after him on lesser penalties.
And Steve, Chia gave us an update on the water situation in Flint. Do you have any additional details on what's happening, whether or not people are still using bottled water, maybe what the percentages are as far as folks who have clean water, if I can even say that?
The latest testing shows that the 90th percentile, the most at-risk homes being tested, their lead quality was about 4 parts per billion, which is well within federal and state standards for lead exposure. Now, ideally, zero lead is what you want in your water, and that's what the majority of homes that are tested are coming back as. That's, you know, the information we've received from the state. There are many people who in Flint will never trust what they hear from the government again about the quality of their drinking water. They were lied to repeatedly for a very long time, and they will never trust, you know, whatever numbers come out about the quality of the drinking water in Flint. That's why when different churches and civic groups have water giveaways, there are always very long lines of people getting in line to get bottled water because, again, they do not trust and will never trust the water coming out of their tap.
Chia, we know that 2020 is a huge election coming up for this country. Presidential candidates are, some of them at least, are talking about the Flint water crisis. And you recently spoke to Julian Castro, who's the former HUD secretary, who was in Flint to talk about this. What did you say to him?
I asked him not to make us a campaign stop or a campaign talking point. I asked him to definitely promise us that win, lose, or draw in 2020, that he would stick with us, help us, you know, fight even on the campaign trail when you're going to these different cities. Give these cities an update on what you found out in Flint here. Ask them to send 10 cases. Ask them to send 20 cases because he's essentially going to touch all 50 states. So those cases add up because, as Steve stated, when we have these water drives, the lines are wrapped around buildings. They're wrapped around streets and corners. So we're still in need of water.
So, Chia, when you see people, particularly on social media, who say, you know, celebrities even, who say Flint still doesn't have clean water, or politicians who use that as a talking point, how do you feel?
You know, there are some celebrities, and I have seen them. I have, you know, witnessed it. They're not just using that as a way to get 1.2 million likes. They're genuinely saying Flint doesn't have clean water. You know, they've been phenomenal. But for too many people, it's just a cool post to make. And for too many candidates, it is just something, you know, oh, we're going to pull at the heartstrings because everyone in the nation felt for Flint. And it is more than disheartening. It just angers you so much that people are just so callous, you know, that they just use you for their own benefit. We're tired of that.
Steve, we are hearing about similar water, tainted water in Newark, New Jersey, for example. And I'm wondering, when you look at this situation, what does it tell you about how difficult it is to essentially hold officials accountable in these types of environmental disasters?
It is difficult to do that, often because the decisions that they make, even if they're making incorrect decisions, they're not necessarily breaking the law with the decisions that they make. For example, the former State Health Department Director, Nick Lyon, who was facing involuntary manslaughter charges because of decisions he made related to a Legionnaire's disease outbreak that occurred at the same time as the Flint water crisis. The question is, did he actually break the law in the decisions that he made? The crux of the charges against him was he didn't notify the public that there was a Legionnaire's disease outbreak, and some people thought that he should have. Well, the department did notify hospitals, did notify doctors to be on the lookout for Legionnaires in Genesee County. They took the steps that they were required to by law and expected to by law. But, you know, did he actually break the law, and were his decisions actually illegal? You know, that's a difficult decision to make. When you're dealing with someone who is, you know, a politician, an elected official, a government official, someone who is making their decisions and they are acting within the law, the way the laws are written, it's difficult then to prosecute them.
Steve Carmody is a reporter with Michigan Radio based in Flint, and Chia Morgan is a Flint resident and activist. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All around the world.
World nigga, no.
Since the end of apartheid 25 years ago, the South African government has promised to chip away at the nearly all-white ownership of the country's farmland. NPR's Daniela Cheslow reports that the recent murder of a winemaker at the center of a land dispute illustrates how this issue is boiling over.
Stellenbosch, the heart of Cape Wine Country, along the nation's coastal southwest. Here, against craggy mountains and a vista of vines, I ride up a rutted dirt path.
It's a little rough entrance for small cars.
Ayanda Tomosi drives. He's 29, a young father, and like more than a quarter of South Africans, he's unemployed. Tomosi used to live in Kayamandi Township down the hill, but there was no room for his expanding family. So he built a shack on land just outside the township. He unlocks the padlock to the front door. It's one room with corrugated metal sheets nailed to a thin wooden frame. Tomosi sleeps on a twin mattress and keeps his clothes in a cardboard box from a washing machine.
We are still skeptical of putting proper things because we don't know when they can come and demolish their shacks.
Shacks like Tomosi's stretch across the horizon. There are about 1,400. Midas Wanana is a leader of this community, and he says black South Africans are taking back what should have been theirs. Under apartheid, black people were banned from owning most land in South Africa.
The white people was grabbed the land. So the land belongs to the black people, not for the white people.
Wanana says this land was just sitting empty, and people in Kayamandi had been asking Stellenbosch for more land for years. This particular property was owned by winemaker Stefan Smit. His family has been on the farm since 1896, and Smit had tried to remove the squatters by court order. Smit ran a vineyard called Luisenhof. On a recent visit, birds chirped on the wooden deck of a tasting room. Smit refused an interview, but he told the New York Times in March he had received death threats. And then, on a Sunday night earlier this month, Smit was home with his wife and a friend when four people burst in and fatally shot him. Smit was 62. Police are searching for suspects. Wanana, the activist, condemned the attack.
We're feeling shame for Mr. Smit. He has a family to look after.
Wanana says this killing was not related to the land invasion. It was just regular crime. President Cyril Ramaphosa says he will make land more equitable. To do that, he says he will amend the Constitution to enable expropriation of land without compensation. This has alarmed landowners. In a campaign stop in Stellenbosch ahead of May elections, Ramaphosa told farmers not to fear land reform.
It is going to be done in accordance with our Constitution. It's not going to be land grabs.
Ramaphosa was reelected, but the amendment is still in the works. Just before Smit's murder, the Stellenbosch municipality had agreed to buy his disputed land, about 150 acres, for roughly $3 million. Stellenbosch municipal manager Geraldine Mettler acknowledges that only about 1,000 families can be housed on Smit's land, and they would be selected according to their position on a list of 22,000 people waiting for homes.
We will never be able, if we cannot give housing in the current form, to be able to address the backlog.
The people living illegally on Stefan Smit's land have renamed it Azania. Women carry buckets of water to their homes. There's a little grocery shop selling cigarettes. Chris Peko seals his home using cloth and a sealant that he brushes on top.
For the wind, also for the rain. So the rain mustn't come through.
Peko says he used to pay 500 rand, or about $45 a month in rent. On the hill, he could build a shack for his family and another for his brother, who's sick.
So we must give each other a space for living.
For NPR News, I'm Daniela Cheslow in Stellenbosch, South Africa.
When are we as black people going to have the level of self-respect and courage to really come out of the slave role, slave obey your master, turn the other cheek. Make certain you turn the other cheek and you'll get your reward in heaven. And that's a slave role. We haven't maybe thought about it in those terms.
The Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, is one of the oldest black congregations in the South. 4 years ago today, people gathered there for Bible study, and they welcomed a stranger who was a white supremacist. He opened fire during the closing prayer, killing 9 people. A new documentary titled Emmanuel tells the stories of those who were killed, including 59-year-old Myra Thompson, who was training to become a minister. Her husband, Reverend Anthony Thompson, spoke with Rachel Martin.
How did you and Myra first meet?
Well, she was on her way to Charleston, South Carolina one morning. However, she missed her bus, and I was coming through the campus, and I said, well, I'm on my way to Charleston. Make a long story short, I offered her a ride home. After that, I just couldn't leave her alone. She just told me what she expected out of life, and everything was no nonsense, and I never heard that from a woman before. I mean, I was like, she put the fear of God in me. Yes, it did.
Can you take me back to that day, the last day? When did you first hear that a shooting had happened at the church?
Well, my phone rang. It was a member of Emmanuel AME Church. She said, Reverend Thompson, you need to go to the church because there's shooting going on. I was like, oh, my God. I dropped my phone. I ran out of the house, got my car. And in 5 minutes, I was downtown because we live downtown. And the police officer had the streets blocked off. And he told me, he said, well, everybody had been taken out of the church and they're over at the hotel, which is adjacent to the church on Calhoun Street. So I drove down. I walk in the door, and I saw Felicia Sanders and her granddaughter, 2 survivors. They were hugging each other, crying. They didn't see me. Then when I turned around to go back out of the door, Felicia Sanders looked at me, and she said, Reverend Thompson, Myra's gone. And I said, oh, well, she'll be back. I'll just wait here till she comes back. She said, no, she's gone. I mean, I just couldn't believe it. I was like, no, she got to be kidding. And finally it kicked in, and I just lost it. I fell down on the pavement of Calhoun Street. I mean, oh, Jesus. And I just cried. I mean, I cried like a baby. First time in my life that I ever lost control. I didn't know what to do. I kept saying, I don't know what to do. You know, for me, all purpose in life was gone. Just gone. And after a while, I heard a voice say, get up. And then I looked around. Nobody was really looking at me, and I heard a voice again, get up. And I'm like, you got to be kidding. This is God. I'm like, why are you talking to me like that? You know, it wasn't like, be of good cheer, fear not, this is the Lord. He was like, get up. And I'm like, okay, this I don't need. And he just kept at it. All I could hear was, okay. Well, this is what I want you to preach on Sunday. And he gave me scripture, St. Luke 17. So watch yourself, but forgive.
In the documentary, there is this overwhelming moment where the judge has invited the families of the victims to come and address the shooter at this bond hearing. And instead of anger, instead of even sadness, the overwhelming message is of forgiveness.
You know, I forgive you and my family forgive you. But we would like you to take this opportunity to repent. Repent. Confess. Give your life to the one who matters the most, Christ.
As soon as I got through saying that, I was free. I mean, I was light as a feather. I mean, I felt a peace. I mean, everything had gone, and I realized that he freed me. He freed me from the pain that I was feeling, from the anger I felt. He freed me from the sadness I had in my heart. I mean, he just took everything away. I mean, it just brought me to tears. I don't know. He just came and took over. Oh, my God. And I feel that same peace right now today. It's not, it hadn't gone. It's still with me. And enable me to move forward in my life.
I want to ask you about that because it was such a statement, such an illustration of grace when you and the other family members stood up there and forgave the person who took the lives of your loved ones. But there were people in Charleston who they saw that and felt that by forgiving the shooter, you had freed him from accountability in some way, that you had given the broader country an easy way to say, these things happen, the only way to deal with it isn't to change gun laws or take on racism at the root cause. It's just to forgive and move on. What do you say to that?
I've told people that the forgiveness is not for the perpetrator or the offender. Forgiveness is for the victim. I didn't let Dylan off the hook. Dylan is in prison, but I'm free. And it changed Charleston.
How so?
You know, where there was this undertone of racism that people, we just didn't talk about. But we came together, you know, as one people. The flag, the Confederate flag came down when nobody was talking about the flag. It's just, it just forgiveness just opened everybody's minds up and started to heal our city. There's a lot going on since that day. You know, God took this tragedy and brought the good, and it all came from acts of forgiveness.
Reverend Anthony Thompson, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me.
In Philadelphia, more than 70 police officers have been taken off their regular duties patrolling the city's streets. Philly is dealing with a scandal over the release of thousands of offensive social media posts by police officers around the country. Police officials there say they're hoping to contain the damage that was done to public trust. Here's NPR's Bobby Allen.
Earlier this month, an advocacy group called the Plain View Project published thousands of Facebook posts by police officers in eight cities. In Philadelphia, 330 active officers were found to have publicly posted racist memes, Islamophobic messages, comments celebrating violence, and other offensive material. Philadelphia Police Commissioner Richard Ross, who's usually mild-mannered, sounded downright angry talking about it to reporters.
It makes me sick, to be honest with you. It really makes me sick because we are in a position to know better.
As the city's internal affairs investigates, Ross says he has placed 72 officers on desk duty. He says it's the largest removal of police from the streets in recent memory. Ross says some of the posts were so bad that he's planning to discipline dozens and fire several on the force.
In many ways, you know, we understand how this can tarnish or did tarnish our reputation. But we will work tirelessly to repair that reputation, to improve police-community relations, as we are equally disgusted.
While Ross was direct about his disapproval of the posts, he also wanted to make another point. The database flagged some 300 officers out of a force of 6,500.
To assume that everybody is a racist and everybody is Islamophobic and everybody is a sexist and all the other things, because they're not. That's just a reality. We are proud of the men and women in this organization. They come to work, they work hard, and they do it in a city that is not easy to do it in.
Paul Hetznecker has been a criminal defense lawyer in the city for more than 30 years. He says the Facebook message scandal is a new reminder of an old problem.
We're all aware of it. There's not anyone that hasn't been connected to the criminal justice system in Philadelphia that isn't aware of the underlying problems of implicit bias and explicit bias, as these posts reflect, that have existed for a long, long period of time, for decades.
Commissioner Ross says following the data dump, new anti-racist and anti-bias training will be launched department-wide, and officials will issue reminders about police social media policy, which prohibits profanity, discriminatory language, or personal insults. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Toxic prisons. Several years ago, the Workers' World newspaper published an article of mine entitled Jailhouse Environmentalist. It told the tale of a prisoner named Bryant Arroyo, a man who responded to the planned placement of a massive gas liquefaction plant right outside the gates of the state prison in Mahanoy in northeast Pennsylvania with action. First, Arroyo did his research. He went to the library and read the environmental impact statement. What he learned of the particulates and chemicals to be released by the plant concerned him even more. He went around the prison and talked to everybody, including the guards, explaining that they too would be exposed to the particulates, and if their families lived close enough, they also would be exposed. Arroyo began the organizing phase, and before long, letters began trickling into the local governing council protesting the plant. The trickle became a flood, and eventually, over 900 letters arrived there. The plant plan was canceled. Arroyo, a bilingual Puerto Rican, had won. When I met him, I told him he was the first jailhouse environmentalist I had ever met. Arroyo then enrolled in correspondence courses with a group known as Environmental Defense Fund to deepen his understanding of environmental law. For example, one thing Arroyo learned was that in Pennsylvania's Constitution, Article 1, Section 27, the following words are written: the people have a right to clean air. Several years ago, the Abolitionist Law Center of Pittsburgh issued a damning report on a Pennsylvania state prison situated right atop a toxic waste dump. The prison became a cancer hotspot, affecting prisoners and staff alike. It remains there today. And finally, what are prisons except sinks of negativity? What are they except places of mass pollution of the spirit, the mind, the psyche? The environment of prisons is one of oppression. We cannot ignore this truth. How can any good come from it? Perhaps that's why such an institution is plagued by recidivism, returnees to prison who cannot cope with home. Any other institution with such a record of malperformance would be shuttered because of such failure. Unfortunately, such is not the case with prison, which is still with us. Only a mass movement can transform this social reality. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
We move into Mississippi, and you know how that spells. M-I, crooked letter I, crooked letter I, hook back, I.
We turn now to news out of the Supreme Court. The court has struck down the conviction of an African-American death row inmate who was prosecuted six times for the same crime and by the same prosecutor. The Mississippi Supreme Court said three times that the prosecutor had a history of prosecutorial misconduct and racial bias in jury selection. This could determine the fate of a Mississippi man who has been in jail for nearly a quarter of a century. NPR's Nina Totenberg is in our studios to talk more about this. Hi, Nina.
Hi, Rachel.
Explain the case for us.
Well, the crime was a horrific crime. It was the murder of four people at a furniture store in Winona, Mississippi. It's a tiny 5,000-person town. 53% to 46% black-white, so there's a black majority. Mm-hmm. Curtis Flowers was arrested. As far as I can tell, there was, you know, there were no eyewitnesses to this crime, at least living, and there wasn't a great DNA kind of case.
Right.
And he was the first three, he was convicted three times. Three times the Mississippi Supreme Court said that the prosecutor had committed prosecutorial misconduct and not some trivial thing, things like lying about evidence that didn't exist and discrimination in the selection of juries.
Then how is he prosecuted three additional times?
Well, the next two times, it's the same prosecutor. There are more than one black juror and the jury deadlocks. Uh-huh. And then in the sixth case, there's only one and he's convicted. And the Mississippi Supreme Court upholds that conviction and the Supreme Court today reversed the conviction because of jury discrimination.
So this was a 7-2 decision. Mm-hmm. The dissenters here were Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch. Justice Thomas, I understand, wrote the opinion. He is the only black justice on the court. What did he have to say about this?
Well, Justice Thomas has always maintained that discrimination in jury selection is just not something the court should be involved in determining, and that it's not for the defense to raise this, that it's only the jurors who can object to being discriminated against. Today, he wrote an opinion for himself and Justice Thomas, and he said he noted that the court had at least once before had this case before it and sent it back for reevaluation. And he said that he couldn't see that they should have looked at it a second time. And he said the court's action only encourages the litigation and relitigation of criminal trials in the media to the potential detriment of all parties, including defendants. The media often seeks to titillate rather than educate and inform. And so that's been his position. His dissenting opinion is like twice as long as the majority opinion, written, I should say, by Justice Kavanaugh.
So what does this mean for the man at the center of it all, Curtis Flowers? Does he go free?
No. The Mississippi can try him again. I don't think they probably can try him in Winona or with that prosecutor. That would not be wise. But if they think that they have a good case, they can try him again. He's been in prison for 22 years. These are tough cases for states to decide when there's an old case to try to see if they have anything that they can persuade a jury that this guy is guilty. And, you know, sometimes they just have to bite the bullet and say, no, we don't. And we got to let him go.
We'll see. NPR's Nina Totenberg on the latest decision out of the U.S. Supreme Court. Nina, thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Is that a real gun?
Yes, this is a real gun.
Do you kill people?
No, if some guy's hurting someone, I try to shoot him in the leg or something just to stop him.
Mama says policemen shoot black people.
Is it true?
Yeah, is it true?
Is that true?
Yeah, is it true?
Is that true?
Is it true?
Some residents of South Bend, Indiana, are raising questions after the shooting death of a black resident by a white police officer. Mayor Pete Buttigieg came off the presidential campaign trail to deal with concerns over bias and the use of body cameras. Justin Hicks of member station WVPE reports.
It was about 3:30 in the morning on Father's Day when Sergeant Ryan O'Neill was dispatched to investigate a call about someone breaking into cars.
There's a subject in the north parking lot wearing all dark clothing with a flashlight, possibly breaking out windows.
Prosecutors say when the officer arrived, he saw two legs sticking out of a car and that when he approached, Eric Logan turned around holding a large knife in one hand. Officer O'Neill told prosecutors he yelled several times for Logan to drop the knife before firing two shots, one into his stomach. Logan was rushed in a police car to the hospital where he later died. And that's about all we know, because Sergeant O'Neill never turned on his body or dashboard cameras. Without footage, there's questions not only about the shooting, but about why Logan was transported to a nearby hospital in a police car rather than an ambulance. South Bend is a city of just over 100,000 people located near Chicago. More than a quarter of residents are black, and the news hit Brenda Bailey hard.
It sank.
During his 7.5 years as mayor, Pete Buttigieg has had uneasy relations with some in South Bend's black community. After the shooting, he left the campaign trail, returning home to coordinate the investigation.
I thought it was important sooner rather than later for us to make clear how this process is going to work and also to state the community's values.
Logan's family members met with Buttigieg and say he promised transparency as the investigation progresses. Shifonia Logan is Eric Logan's wife.
It's a lot of rumors out there, but nobody knows what went on but the police and him. He's not here to tell it.
Documents from an internal police investigation also surfaced, showing that trainees had accused O'Neill of making racist remarks about blacks and Muslims while on duty. The department determined them to be, quote, not sustained. The major focus has been on body cameras and why O'Neill's wasn't turned on. Councilmember Regina Williams-Preston says that the city spent $1.5 million on cameras to try to avoid situations like this.
How can we trust our police department when we put all of those elements in place, but we don't follow through?
Mayor Buttigieg ordered the chief of police to notify officers that body cameras were expected to be on during all interactions with civilians. At a swearing-in ceremony for new officers, he encouraged them to act with restraint and equity.
We gather in the wake of a shooting that has left family members grieving the loss of someone they love, and also leaves an officer and his family dealing with the consequences of that encounter.
Late Wednesday, a meeting to talk about gun violence took on a new life in the wake of the shooting. More than 50 community leaders and activists stood in a large circle on an outdoor basketball court. Pete Buttigieg showed up unannounced and listened, sometimes taking direct criticism. Here's Wayne Hubbard.
I know it's not your fault you were not here when it happened, but these systems were here. They have to stop. People are dying.
While the investigation continues, Buttigieg is set to return to the campaign trail today with events scheduled in Florida and South Carolina. For NPR News, I'm Justin Hicks in South Bend.
As your body grows bigger,
your mind must flower. It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
It's Schoolhouse Rockin', the chip off the block of your favorite Schoolhouse Rockin'.
The U.S. government says there is no way of knowing how often schools restrain or seclude students. Restricting a child's ability to move or isolating them are practices meant as last resorts. They're supposed to be used only when a child becomes dangerous to themselves or others. School districts have to tell the government how often they do this, but as NPR has reported, districts don't always keep accurate records. Today, the Government Accountability Office agreed. Jenny Abamu of member station WAMU reports.
In the past, officials from the GAO said public schools rarely use seclusion and restraint. But now, those same officials aren't so sure.
There is widespread underreporting and misreporting of seclusion and restraint data, and we don't know the extent to which seclusion and restraint is happening in public schools.
That's Jackie Nowicki, author of a new report from the GAO, basically the federal government's watchdog. She says seclusion and restraint data helps the federal government craft policy and enforce civil rights laws.
Absent accurate data, it's difficult to see how education can systematically address the potential misuse of these practices, which, you know, leave some of the nation's most vulnerable public school children at serious risk.
Nowicki says existing data suggests seclusion and restraint mostly happens to children with disabilities. She and her team found that in the 2015-16 school year, 70% of districts nationwide claimed they never secluded or restrained students. In some cases, they reported zero incidents, when in fact, accurate data wasn't available. Among the districts reporting zero were several of the nation's largest, including New York City, Broward County, Florida, and Fairfax County, Virginia.
As a parent, it makes me honestly so sad.
That's Pamela Ananiwu. Two of her children attend the public special needs school in Fairfax County, just outside Washington, D.C. The district reported zero incidents of seclusion and restraint for many years. But following a WAMU investigation, the system is now reporting almost 1,700 cases for the 2017-18 school year alone. Ananiwu says both of her children have been secluded and restrained, and she describes the experience as traumatic.
My son, he's a kindergartner, so that was like his first sort of introduction to school.
Restraint and seclusion are supposed to be a last resort, when students become a danger to themselves or others. Reporting requirements are there to ensure these methods are used appropriately. Kevin Rubenstein is a veteran educator in the Chicago suburbs and has worked with students with special needs for many years.
We all need to remember that while it's not super exciting to admit that this is going on in your schools, there is a lot that we can all learn from this process.
And those lessons can help reduce the use of seclusion and restraint. Rubenstein also says that in some smaller districts, the number of incidents could really be zero. But it's difficult to be sure when districts are hesitant to address and monitor these practices. The GAO says the U.S. Department of Education needs to take, quote, immediate action to remedy misreporting. Education Department officials acknowledged that the figures from some districts are questionable and said they've asked for a review. When asked about the accuracy of their data, they maintained that overall, it is reliable. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Abamu in Washington. The dead presidents is all my niggas name. Dining with the governor's daughter and the father say I remind him of Obama. I'm the chief diplomat every day and I'm black and white. Janelle Monae. It won't be the game, but long live the chief. For a little old thing, little boys bang bang. Long live the chief. Niggas fighting over rings, niggas won't be the game, but long live the chief. Now watch pretty mama while I slay my cane. Long live the chief.
Oh, but God works in mysterious ways.
I want to go to something that Mitch McConnell said yesterday. Take a little listen.
I don't think reparations for something that happened 150 years ago for whom none of us currently living are responsible is a good idea. We've tried to deal with our original sin of slavery by fighting a civil war, by passing landmark civil rights legislation. We've elected an African-American president. I think we're always a work in progress in this country, but no one currently alive was responsible for that. And I don't think we should be trying to figure out how to compensate for it. First of all, it'd be pretty hard to figure out who to compensate.
One could say your treatment of that African-American president was a symptom of a little bit of the behavior that we're talking about. But what are your thoughts on that? Just what he said there.
It was pretty obvious. I'm glad you pointed out his treatment of that African-American first president was the way he said, no matter what, my biggest goal will be to make sure that, first off, he's a one-term president. Number two, fine, that's a party thing. You want to do what's a partisan talk. But also to block everything that he will present, put forward, or anything that will cause any kind of difference in the country. Mm-hmm. So I remember when Obama first came in, and there was the issue with, I think it was a Harvard professor, and it was the beer summit, mm-hmm. because he somehow he was harassed outside of his own house because the police, for some reason, didn't realize he was there. When Trayvon Martin was murdered by his neighbor, and then President Obama said, hey, if I had a son, he could be Trayvon. People pulled their hair out. Like, how could this divisive president keep talking about race in this country? So what annoys me is when you can say we elected this black president, yet you had no interest in working with that black president. Mm-hmm. So the whole point of having a black president, even for folks who were against him, was to say, hey, we're done with that now, right? Mm-hmm. Can we stop talking about this whole thing? We had a black president, get off my damn back. Mm-hmm. That is what he's essentially saying. And also, hey, I wasn't around then. I didn't benefit from our ancestors and the humans they owned. So why are we worried about estate taxes? Why are we worried about handing things down to your kids? Why are we worried about building up wealth and then handing it down to your kids can have a better life? Mm-hmm. I thought that's a legacy of economic legacy. It didn't happen 150 years ago. It doesn't continue. Did it just start with Mitch McConnell's father? All that is BS. We already know it. But he can just say it and move on because no one's going to listen to him talk slow.
It seems that McConnell is really kind of embracing this mentality that I got in law school and that I think our society has clung to, and it kind of, as they say, fetishizes Brown v. Board of Education and thinks that after that, all racism ended. Everything was desegregated and everything was fine. But of course, there was nothing to address the housing issues and the segregation that was created by the federal government back around the time where they had the New Deal. And in the Federal Housing Authority manual, it pretty much said that whites will get benefits financially to have home ownership. Also, whites were subsidized to have home ownership. They would pay less in rent for the homes they did than for the apartments that they were built by the government that they could live in pretty much at low cost, while blacks could not, and blacks could not own property. They could not get loans. They could not own property ownership, which pretty much put whites generational in terms of wealth a whole leg above the black community. Those are things that have happened relatively recently. Again, my grandfather, 103 years old. He can tell you about that stuff. There are people still living. So to act like, oh, we fixed it all and we gave you a black president on top of it. No, that's trash.
Yeah, to sort of echo what you're saying, I think what he does is just dismiss our existence, right? Yes. Mitch McConnell is, I don't think you could manifest a worse kind of human spirit or energy, to be honest
with you.
Lindsey
Graham.
Facts. Look at you. There,
okay. But
I can give you two more.
You're like, okay, I take it back.
But the idea is that this dismissal, right, of black life, that's been consistent. The one thing that, you know, and to give it some context, is that, you know, you mentioned Tulsa. Mm-hmm. I could literally take you from Wilmington, North Carolina, all the way to the western part of North Carolina's state, and Tulsa happened systematically through North Carolina, just like it did throughout every part of the country where black people were actually thriving and surviving. To the conversation about reparations and his idea that black, you know, there's no way for me to,
there's nothing we can do,
right? Yeah. Is this idea, we have to know where reparations went.
Right.
And there were reparations given. They just didn't go to black people.
No, they did not.
When the Civil War was over,
mm-hmm.
and folks went into the South and realized that left to their own devices, black people were all right because we had skills and worked with our hands coming out of enslavement period. The people who did not have the skills and needed the assistance were poor whites. There's a few books that really speak to this. One is White Trash, written by Nancy Eisenberg. It's a masterful book,
mm-hmm.
That people need to check out because she has raw facts in there about what happened to the reparations and to the promise that was made to black people that was never fulfilled. And then there's another book called Stamped from the Beginning,
okay.
written by Ibram X. Kendi, who evolved the same sort of understanding that this period of life for us was us at our very worst. And there was never addressed our situation the way it needed to be, right? The way that we needed to be ushered into this new world where suddenly you've got people in bondage. And again, sort of being able to breathe your own air. That was all the freedom that existed for most of us.
That's it.
So to come out of that into, well, here's the world with no assistance is something that he's dismissing. And he's dismissing the fact that you pointed to. I'm 38 years old, right? I don't have a grandparent that was born after 1924. My grandmother was born in 1905. My grandfather was born in 1911. So the stories that my grandmother told me before she passed were literally of this era.
Yes.
My father, who's 81 now or 82, my dad never went to school, an integrated school. Never.
Right.
I went and spoke at his 50th or 60th high school reunion. Never went to integrated schools. My father tells me stories of living the majority of his life until he decided to go to New York, absent of white people. He lived in a world where he wasn't affected. So the stories that I got were completely different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The information that grandma passed on to us was of a time where things were completely lopsided and unequal, and we didn't have rights. My grandfather, he was an anti-integrationist as a black man.
Yeah.
He had felt the sting of what the white encroachment into black life or white imposition had done to black life, and he wanted to defend not only his family, but he wanted to defend the community that he helped build.
Something that you two touched on that I want to talk a little bit about, because this report came out that I saw this last week, and it was called The Plunder of Black Wealth in Chicago. Mm. New findings and the lasting toll of predatory housing contracts. Yeah. I think everyone here at least knows about redlining in Chicago. Mm. And there is a reason that a lot of predominantly black areas are by the interstate in terribly polluted areas.
Yes.
That was purposeful.
Yes.
But this is just in Chicago. Researchers found that the predatory housing contracts meant that black homebuyers in Chicago during this era lost, in the era, I think it's just in, I want to say, the 50s through 1970, they lost between $3.2 billion and $4 billion of wealth. And so for him to stand there and say that, I think it also minimizes that this is not just gross, greedy black people wanting some money. Yeah.
Right.
Nobody's gonna get rich off reparations. But you keep talking about bootstraps, so give us some. You know what I mean?
Exactly. And reparations comes in many different forms, even just education.
Right.
Like, put all the things that we've done or we suffered in some books so people can understand our plight and what we've overcome and what we've gone through and what we've been put through. Like, stop trying to whitewash it, make it sound like it's okay and we just don't have it together. Put the facts down so that everyone knows what history looks like and where we've come from.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, July 22nd, 2019. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, questions, counter-racist suggestions, or info, constructive info to share. The number to dial, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I thought there was. I was hearing some crazy noises from somewhere in the galaxy. Anyway, the number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I will say, this broadcast, specifically the compensatory call-in, one aspect of this is for victims of racism to be able to exchange views about white supremacy, racism, counter-racist suggestions, how we can go about solving this problem, constructive information in general, reviewing things that have happened over the last week or so we can be informed about white supremacy, racism, locally, nationally, globally. Within that, also reviewing, sometimes it's reviewing how white supremacy, racism is practiced within news segments, words that are used, metaphors, even in that final segment, I would say especially in that final segment on reparations, so-called. When they got to the end, and that was the Young Turks, when they got to the end of the segment, and we're talking about putting this information in a book about what has been done to black people, victims of white supremacy in total, many of those books already exist. We're reading one right now, Sundown Towns, James Loewen. Lots of information about exactly what they were talking about, how white people deliberately went about making sure that black people didn't have access to schools, housing, jobs, or they went about stealing all of these things from the black people all over the so-called country. Lots of those details. We spent about 2 months reading that book, maybe a little more than that. And there are others. When they were talking about Chicago specifically, we had Beryl Satter as a guest on the program. That's the repetitiveness of all of this stands out to me greatly. Beryl Satter was a guest on our program in 2015. She is a white woman, suspected white supremacist. Her book, Family Property. Her father, her white dad, is one of the whites who owned property and rented it to black people. Now, he is allegedly one of the well-meaning white people who recognized the terrorism in all of this and tried to call attention to it and do better, allegedly. However, he was one of these white renters to black people. She acknowledges that in the book. I asked her if it was terrorism. She said yes. On the program, it's 2015. You can go back in the archives and listen. But the repetitiveness. I don't know if you all remember the cows. We've been here for a decade. I remember 2016. My God, that was one of the worst years ever. Woo. I remember we started that year. They were talking about reparations. That was the beginning of 2016 with the political campaign. This was Trump's road to the White House, or how Trump became president in 2016, it started with talk about reparations. That I posted, people who follow me on social media at Until Justice, I posted Ta-Nehisi Coates. It was, that's what I said, it was all, it just, they pulled everything out again. Ta-Nehisi Coates was talking about reparations. He wrote a big piece. They scolded Bernie Sanders, suspected racist, because they said that he didn't give an acceptable response. He said he wouldn't support reparations, and he gave his reasons why. They went and they talked about it and talked about it. They got some black people to come out and scold Ta-Nehisi Coates for reprimanding Bernie Sanders. It just went on and on and on. This was a major part of it. And there were no reparations. They didn't cut any checks. They didn't issue any checks. They didn't come up with any programs, education or otherwise, as a form of remedy. They had all of this talk. The talk concluded. And at the end, Donald J. Trump, new president. This looks very similar, where they will go around, particularly because it's the same thing. It's very much focused on most of the so-called Democratic opposition or people who would be opposing Trump. What do you think about reparations? Should this be done? What's your stance if you're elected? That sort of thing. And then they, you know, parse their responses. But this is very similar. I've seen this before, four more years, which is basically what I've said. I don't know, since 2016, I thought this was going to be two terms, seeing nothing that would change my view. Anyway, before we get to the callers, a listener wrote in, and I wanted to make sure I got their commentary, untiljustice@gmail.com. I do try to read if people take the time to write in to share their thoughts or opinions on a particular matter. So this person wrote in. Let's see. I'm hoping I don't have to do a whole lot to set this up. Okay, so last week I gave information about a victim of racism, non-white male. He's in a tragic arrangement, insert cowbell, with a white woman. Unfortunately, well, double whammy. So they both work on the same job, apparently, in a postal office. And so one of their white coworkers had been making sexually inappropriate comments to this non-white male. Apparently he knows about the tragic arrangement, so he'd been saying things. So I talked about this last week. He brought this up again. And in fact, he gave us an update on workplace racism yesterday that his suspected racist partner did speak up and say something about it. And that solved the problem immediately, which is what I had said when I first heard about all of this, that she might be practicing racism because she could have easily halted all of this in about 30 seconds. So, different listener heard all of this information and wrote in to share. I was listening to yesterday's workplace racism broadcast where a caller is married to a white woman and was asking for advice on how to deal with his predator boss. An article came out where a black male sat in jail for 28 years because a white woman dreamed she was raped and accused him. Dr. Curry talks about that, has written about that repeatedly. It is in the Man Not genre, race class genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood. But he talks about that case specifically. Dreaming that you did it is enough to constitute evidence and a conviction. Continuing, it's the same in the Central Park 5 case where a white woman used her power to ruin the lives of innocent black people. I mentioned the caller from workplace racism because he's married to a white woman, which there is confirmed evidence that the manager is sexually harassing her, but she has yet to use her power and report a sexual harassment claim against him. She did do this eventually. I guarantee he would be fired immediately. Linda Ferenstein from the Central Park jogger case years prior refused to get a white rapist murderer convicted because she simply felt bad for him. I don't like white women at all. I was listening to Neely Fuller Jr. and he explained that victims don't find white people attractive. They find what they can do attractive. Important distinction. My question is, does it mean victims get into relations, friendships, dating with white people because white people mistreat black people and get away with it? Question. I guess other folks, if you're listening, if you have a response to the question, feel free. My answer, I don't think that's it. I mean, that I don't think victims feel bad when these white people racist mistreat them or other people that they care about. What I think is attractive is power. Power is attractive. Seeing people who have resources, seeing people who are not being mistreated, seeing people who are not subject to terrorism, and people who can stop terrorism immediately, who have the power, much more power than you do, where they can use their words to stop something, even if we want to stay right in the context of the situation presented with this white woman, black male. This black male attempts to speak up, use his words to be a man to defend his woman. It totally fails. In fact, they reprimand him for raising his voice on the job. His partner, white woman, she can speak up and use her words. The problem is immediately solved. That is, generally speaking, attractive. Seeing people who are able to solve problems efficiently, even can solve your problems efficiently, that is attractive. And white people have that power. They have the ability to do a tremendous amount of things all over the world. That is easily demonstrated. That, I think, is what's attractive, not necessarily them mistreating other black people. That's not, I don't think so. I mean, that could be the case for some individuals, but I mean, they would be extremely intensely victimized, which we all are. But I think generally speaking, it's more so just the power of what they have, the ability to get things done, and maybe even a hope that they might be able to keep us safe in some sense. But again, if other folks have a thought or response to that, feel free. This was a question. You can share your view. Let's see. Other things before we get to folks who dialed in. We are 4 years from the massacre at the Charleston AME Church, Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. White terrorist expert on racism, according to his own testimony, Dylan Roof. Race soldier, white supremacist. 4 years after that attack, I don't know if people saw a lot, heard a lot. I know a lot of times if it's Sandy Hook or something that white people deem to be significant and should be memorialized, they'll make a big to-do about it. Sometimes that, or frequently, that is not the case for important events for black people or things that should be important to black people, victims of white supremacy. So I don't know if that was mentioned, talked about. This week, they have that documentary film that they talked about that's supposed to be focusing on forgiveness. I thought it was so important. The commentary that Dr. Frances Cress Welsing provided, that's why I put that sound clip in. She spent a good bit of the program when she was here in 2015 talking about how in her practice as a clinical, as a general and child psychiatrist, she did not focus on forgiving. If you get to that point eventually, that's fine. She focused on processing accurately what happened, coming to a place where you can accept that process and move forward from that. And if you get to a place where you want to forgive, whatever that means, the maldoer, the individual that harmed you, okay. But that is not a component of mental health, and that is not something that she focused on. And she, in her own brilliance and eloquence, explained that during her visit in 2015. I thought that was so important, and I've written about that before. I think that is pathological, deliberately pathological, when whites focus our attention on forgiveness. We've talked about this before, but particularly with this incident, with all of the ghoulishness of it. Remember how, or I don't know if people remember, but there were reports that he had scouted other churches, that he had been stalking this church, calling this church, preparing to carry out this attack for a long time, and maybe even other sites. This is not a, oh, yes, we forgive, not at all. This is correctly processing what Dr. Welsing termed end stage white supremacy, terrorism. And I would add, I have been saying for some time, and I have written about this as well, that is a new genre. They will have more films on dead black people. What is one of the terms, our key terms for the duration of the context of white supremacy has been necrophilia. They will just pile them up. I would add Central Park 5 in there, but they'll just be, it'll be the one on Khalif Browder. They have the one on Jordan Davis. They have the one on the Central, not the Central Park 5, on the Charleston massacre. Trayvon Martin. They just keep adding. They have, I think, one on Sandra Bland. They just keep adding. Michael Brown Jr. They'll just keep adding. I'm sure it'll be one on Tamir Rice at some point. More to come. They had the incident in South Bend this weekend. Maybe that'll be a documentary too. I do not see how just making more and more films on dead black people who are victims of white terrorism, I have no idea how making more and more films of this is going to solve the problem. And then at the same time, while they keep piling up, Netflix will just be full with dead black people films, then at the same time say that white people are ignorant about all of this. Next. Oh, and there, well, I'll get past that. If speaking of Central Park 5, I mentioned this last week. I'm really only mentioning this not because I'm interested. I have no intention of watching the Netflix docudrama, I guess it's being called, on the Central Park 5. But I am aware that this is supposed to be very popular. So if people have watched it with kind of a counter-racist understanding, if you have a thought, I know, I think Thomas in New York said he thought it was constructive. I think some other listeners had maybe a different perspective. I think some people said that they did not think it was so constructive. They thought it had a substantial amount of anti-blackness and also some focus on gender confusion, contempt for gender, the LGBTQI issue, which seemed kind of surprising and very mysteriously related, if at all, to what is taking place with the Central Park 5 case. Those are some of the reviews I've heard. So if other people have seen the film and have a thought on, is this a constructive investment and why so? Your counter-racist thought, I guess you can share, although I'm not super excited. But that is a major amount of time to invest in a film. Let's see. Next. Wow. I can only speaking of gender confusion, contempt for gender. I can only say in the system of racism, white supremacy, there are a few things that I have come to conclusions on. I think one of them, non-white people victims of racism are all of us, Gusty, all of us are going through an extraordinary amount of trauma. Being mistreated in a variety of different ways, even though we are experiencing racism differently, depending on where we are, how old you are, what part of the world you're in. Are you predominantly around non-white people, so you're experiencing racism in a different way? Are you predominantly around whites? It's going to be different, but manifesting in the same mistreatment, stress, terrorism. One of my observations for victims of racism, I think frequently, in our stress and strife of racism, and Dr. Welsing, she talked about not being willing to honestly address reality and confront our problems and figure out ways to deal with and solve some of our problems, mainly being caused by whites. We will get off into other distractions. One of those distractions, or I think one of the ones that's encouraged in this system, is frequently at the genital level. That's why the LGBTQI will be heavily promoted. I've seen where, particularly areas where I am, where that's heavily promoted. It's Pride Weekend, in addition to it being the solstice, right in Seattle. My goodness, I'm so glad I'm not directly around that this time of year, but they've taken over Broadway and downtown Seattle. I was right in the middle of all that trying to get to my teacher training this time last year, but all of that is going on in Seattle right now. It can be very easy to be engulfed, I'll even use the term deliberately, contaminated by that. The system of white supremacy, I think a lot of times can make stimulating our genitals, distracting us with things for our genitals, they can make that much more appealing, much more entertaining, much more fun, much more attractive, if we want to use that word, than dealing with the probably a lot less fun realities and problem solving of white supremacy, racism, and really counter racism. That's something that I've seen. Make sure that I'm being specific victims of racism, non-white people, can frequently be distracted to just be involved in a lot of sexual activity or things stimulating your genitals when it does not solve our problems at all. Frequently, it can just create more problems. I would be very mindful of that. Even individuals that you're around, be very mindful of that. When you're stressed, having problems, solutions that others present, or even solutions that you come up with yourself, somehow it routes back to just sexual activity, stimulating your genitals, something in the area of sex that is not really directly solving our problems. Be very, very mindful about that. That is super dangerous and super prevalent in my observation, my conclusion. Next. Let's see. Speaking of solving our problems and trying to be a little bit more helpful with how we use our bodies, take care of ourselves, definitely promoting trying to eat as well as we can, drink our water, get some exercise in. I certainly will do my part to promote yoga, but if that's not your thing, pick something, hiking, exercise of some form. It is super important for victims of racism, white supremacy. It has such an enormous impact on your health and well-being just to get some exercise in. Racists, they want us to be very stationary. Get that alcohol, eat that bad food, get those Cheetos, watch a little bit more television, all that white supremacy on the streaming Netflix or whatever it's going to be. That's what they're going to encourage. That is not going to help us solve the problem. It is the solstice, summertime, get out and exercise. I've been trying to see if we could get our Labor Day retreat together, but it's just too short notice, and we just won't have enough folks to be able to do the Labor Day retreat with the short notice. I think I'd said repeatedly at the beginning, like, wow, to do summer event planning, which I am a novice. Wow, I now understand why you have to plan way in advance. Also, being someone who does not have children, I am not familiar with, oh, now you have to plan for individuals and what they're going to be doing for 3 months. And people generally like to make those plans early as possible. Lesson learned. I will make sure that we strive to do that earlier. I think I had said all that before. I now understand why people promote yoga retreats like a year in advance, 6-8 months in advance, to make it very, very easy for people to schedule their time, especially in the summer. However, for me, it just means we get to, or I can focus on Florida, which I've been saying. End of December, I contacted retired firefighter. I think I mentioned when we were in Virginia. Thank goodness survived. When we were in Virginia for the retreat earlier this year, and I requested retired firefighter if he could do some homework to see if he could find us a location, preferably owned by a black person that would be willing to host us. I was able to speak with him over the week, this week, to see if we could have the retreat in Miami, black owned facility with a pool, I think he said. I have to double check. I've not seen pictures, but I think he did say there is a pool at the facility. So we shall see. End of December, we'll give details and updates so that people will have much more time to plan. And then for 2020, all of the dates and cities, times will be planned well in advance to make it very easy for folks to plan and attend. I think it is super worthwhile to invest. I think folks who participated the first time around, I think they said that they felt it was a constructive use of time and energy. And even just to get a few more people who do a little bit better with their eating, do a little bit better with their exercise, and get some practice exchanging views, counter-racist views, worthwhile. So I will update about Florida. That is the end of December, going to January 1. We'll update with details once I get have my continued conversation with our victim down in Florida and see if we can use his facility. We'll give out all of the pertinent details and be ready to roll for December. That is the goal. Let's see. I think that is it. With that, compensatory call-in. This is the only program where I ask that we not use metaphors. Now, in that segment where they were talking about the situation in Charleston, the massacre, terrorist assault in Charleston, the victim of racism, he said that God took that tragedy and he healed the city. That is a metaphor. I don't think Charleston had a gaping wound or a broken arm. I think that there were specific black people and black families in that event that were some fatally wounded and otherwise injured. That is a metaphor. He said that the act of forgiving healed the city. That is another metaphor. He said that this event prompted the flag being taken down. I think these are some of the things that I wrote about and pointed out before. The symbols, metaphors. We're not talking in a tangible, deliberate manner about solving a problem. And that is characteristic of conversations on white supremacy, racism. There will be a lot of vague metaphors, unclear metaphors that appeal to emotion and don't really encourage logical thinking, thinking in a problem-solving manner. That is the standard with regards to racism, white supremacy. Non-white people, we are encouraged to think and appreciate dialogue on racism and to think that we're making progress if it sounds that way. Yes, we're healing a city and healing a nation. And yes, more hope. In my view, racist, white supremacists, this is one of the standard tactics of deception. You use these metaphors, analogies, comparisons. You use them in a deliberately deceptive manner. Frequently, they will insist that two separate entities are identical, and often that is not the case. Victims of racism, we have been exposed to this misconduct for a long period of time. Many individuals, including myself, we are still learning. As such, often we will substitute an analogy, a comparison of some sort, because we don't have logic. We haven't fully formed our opinion or conclusion. Frequently, when we just rely on these analogies and comparisons, it just produces more confusion. If we could be direct, explicit about what it is that we want to say, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Much obliged. We are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. Tremendous thanks to all of the investors, listeners who have kept us broadcasting for a decade. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email. We'll get you a physical mailing address. Also, extraordinary thanks to the folks who have nabbed items from our wish list. It is at Amazon, Gus T. Renegade. Also linked at my blog, should be right under the PayPal button. Huge thanks. Hope the program has been and continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Again, remind folks the question that was written in. Does it mean victims of racism, non-white people who get into relations, friendships, dating with white people because white people mistreat black people and get away with it? Is that what's motivating non-white people to pursue these arrangements? Is that what they find to be attractive about white people? The fact that they mistreat black people and get away with it? Do people think that's what's motivating? You can give us a response to that or your own thoughts, observations, questions for the past week. *61 if you dialed in and have commentary. If you dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello, Gus?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, hi. Evening to you, callers and listener. It's Bee from Toronto. Yes. In order to answer the question with the letter regarding interracial dating, I believe, because I've come across this, that non-whites who are dating whites are attracted to that proximity to power. And it's more of a projection of what the non-white would like to have, which is that power. So similar to what you were mentioning, in that it may have been just being able to, if they're not able to wield that power, then at least being close to someone who could wield that power. I hope that is along the lines that you were mentioning, because that's how I had interpreted that. Also, I went through a portion of the newscast that you had put together, and here were some of my thoughts in regards to the interview with Reverend Anthony Thompson about his wife, Mrs. Myra Thompson, who was murdered. I believe that these types of interviews are, again, trauma porn for white supremacists. And I also agree that it is rather pathological, in which they would implement the mistreatment, they would be the cause of death, and then they want to hear how the tragedy has affected. It's akin to a serial killer obtaining their trophy after the kill, in which and being able to relive the trauma that they've caused. So yes, it's very pathological indeed. I find that it's also interesting when they're talking about forgiveness, or when they talk about the tragedy that occurred at the Charleston church, they don't identify, or they rarely identify the victims as being murdered. Here in Canada, they seem to be more identified as being killed or taken away, but mainly killed. And the reason why I wanted to mention that is it has legal implications in terms of the two terms, killed and murder. To kill is an action causing unnatural death without intent, whereas murder is an action to cause unnatural death with intent. So the correct legal term would be murder, and I would really recommend that this term be used, because the media likes to input, again, incorrect terms that do not accurately describe the actual events. What I also find what was interesting is that there is no talk, similar to what Dr. Joy DeGruy had mentioned about, you know, had there been any mental health assistance, has there been any trauma assistance? I would be curious to find out if there was any trauma assistance given to Reverend Anthony Thompson and other victims, and also victims by proxy, regarding the Charleston case, or much less any other traumatic event that is racially motivated. And the reason I ask this is when Reverend Thompson talks about how he heard a voice telling him to get out and a sense of peace, To me, that sounds like shock and adrenaline at that time. Although he may have thought that it was a voice from God or a voice from a separate entity, that sounds like trauma and adrenaline to me. And then it sounds like he's still trying to make sense of the situation. But I mean, the sheer grief, I literally envisioned him, even though I don't know if this is the case, but I could literally envision him after the media has moved on to another story, you know, still crying to sleep at night over the loss of his wife and perhaps, you know, trying to figure out what could he have done different. You know, if there was survivor's guilt. So that's another thing that I was looking at. The other thing too that I was also intrigued about is the schools not knowing how often children are restrained. I have some experience in this situation where staff are trained around the areas of restraint, especially if a child and or adult are in a situation where they're harmed to themselves or to others. Generally, it's used as a last resort. Verbal de-escalation is what usually helps, I would say, in my experience, 99.9% of the time. So it's really interesting that the federal government does not have statistics on this. So it was interesting how, again, with these terms, they're talking about, restraint and confined, when really, if it's being used, and it's not quite sure if it's being used as a last resort, it's technically criminal assault and unlawful detention by school staff, if that is indeed happening. And that means that the children are being, who are affected, are being traumatized. And then if they're unable to express as to what's occurred to their parents because they're scared, and then they're having to be re-traumatized, you know, going to school, being scared as to whether or not this is going to happen to them again because there was no consequence, like, that's a concern. I mean, the staff who are doing this should be criminally prosecuted. And it's beyond me as to how there could not be any data, other than it's the willful negligence of the school administrations who are participating in that. Because if a restraint is used, the appropriate protocol is to write an incident report, and that incident report is sent to the appropriate department within the government to review, because then that's going to justify as to whether a particular child needs additional services, which means additional monies for that school to help that child. So, like, it's if these restraints are being used as a punitive measure, then that is a very real concern, and especially considering that many of Black children are being redirected. Oh, sorry, many of Black children are being redirected into so-called special ed courses or special ed, courses due to conduct behavior and not necessarily learning disabilities or developmental disability or physical disability. Again, that's a concern for parents to please keep a close eye on the school and what they do and monitor child's responses. If there's any fear being noted, then to investigate further. Thank you. I leave my line.
Much obliged to be in Toronto. Excellent suggestions, whether you are in Toronto or any other part of the world. And I thought it was so important with that segment on them strangely not having data about school restraints. That seems like something that is so important, and they just can't seem to find the data. Again, white women any problems that are happening in the school, all the data that I have seen, the number consistently is about 70% of the teachers in public schools, at least in the States, I'm sure it's got to be something similar or worse in Canada, 70% are white women. So if they're having problems getting these data on restraints in the school, it would seem, just according to the numbers, white women would have to be an integral part of that problem. Just following logic. Other folks who dialed in, if we could all take about 5 minutes to make sure everybody gets an opportunity to share, and then we can share extra once everyone's spoken at least once. Others who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Henry in Chicago.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. You had a clip on the on the Flint water crisis. I want people to pay attention to another crisis here in the Chicagoland area. This is in the place called University Park. It is actually about 20 miles south of Chicago, and it is experiencing a high lead water crisis in that particular suburb. The suburb is predominantly non-white Black. I think the last census said about 80% of the residents there are Black. So we are in the beginning stages of a Flint water crisis here. Apparently, about a year and a half ago, the city switched water systems, and they discovered lead in it, but they didn't report it until a couple of weeks ago, because I guess the lead got higher and higher. So now they're suggesting to people in that area not to drink the water. Like I said, I think this is the start of a Flint water crisis here in this part of the world called the Chicagoland area, or in the specific suburb of University Park. In regards to the anniversary of the Charleston shooting and forgiveness, whites like to use forgiveness due to the fact that they use white Christianity or the religion of white supremacy as a basis of it, and I think that's where they get that thing of forgiveness. But I didn't hear anybody forgive the people who rammed the planes into the building in 9/11. I don't think anybody forgave them, and other incidents where white people were killed. I don't remember white people getting up forgiving those type of people. So I agree with Dr. Welsing. It's some sort of mental health issue when you're talking about forgiving somebody without, you know, without healing. I think on your program on Wednesday, Dr. Joy DeGruy had a great metaphor, and I'm just saying this because it was on your show, about breaking somebody's leg and fixing it and then breaking it again. You can't keep breaking the leg and expecting it to heal all, you know, every time. I'm paraphrasing it, but you know what I'm talking about in regards to that. But that's all I have right now in my life.
Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. Dr. Joy DeGruy in the archives. You can check it out. I do remember that metaphor. Excellent. That's why I said, I never say we should not, we should permanently discontinue metaphors. I just say we should not use them for this program, just really as an exercise about being mindful. Words are important, but certainly metaphors can be used to tremendous effect. Dr. DeGruy, this past Wednesday. Other folks who dialed in that we have missed totally, if you have commentary to share. And thank you for the update on the situation in Chicago, because I'm sure, I think they mentioned Newark in the clip. I did not know about that in Chicago. So thank you for the update. Please keep us posted. I know Pam would want us to be aware. Other folks that we've missed totally, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to everybody. DCS program, I showed up today, and Mr. Clark informed me that he was going to take the guys on a field trip, and I decided not to go. Basically, what it was something involving recreation, whereas primarily the assistants would have been, you know, just chaperoning. It wouldn't have been much of anything else. Some kind of bounce house type of thing where they would exert a lot of energy, that sort of thing, which actually I wouldn't have mind if the parents themselves showed up to that. But anyway, through the different sessions in the different classes that we have to come through, what is a general consensus out of the quote unquote mentors is that this is something that all non-white black people need to participate in as far as being mentored, which is something that I think makes sense, also. The question, if I am not mistaken on what the question was stating, something to the light of a white person having more power than a non-white person, and the non-white person involved in a relationship with a white person would admires that difference in power. Is that something towards what the question is asking?
Specifically, a non-white person, if they are attempting a so-called arrangement, friendship, or whatever it is with a white person, are they doing it because they are attracted to that white person mistreating black people? That was the specific question.
Well, I would say under the global system of racist white supremacy and the results of it to non-white victims, it could be that type of situation. It's all kinds of mental issues, poor mental health as a result of the global system of racist white supremacy. But there's so many other things that are incorrect to be in a sexual or some sort of idea in mind of thinking that you're going to be in a quote-unquote friendship with a white person. That I've never even thought about that particular situation as much. Retreat in itself. Hopefully that last contact that I gave would come through with something successful. Other than that, I don't have an update at all as far as a possible non-white black person that would have facilities that would accommodate what the retreat would be asking for. It would be pretty tough as far as South Florida. Most of the South Florida non-white black people moved on to Atlanta, general area, about maybe 20 years ago. Central Park 5 movie. I have a problem with movies in itself. There's even something wrong with documentaries that could be, in the hands of white people, anything could be contaminated, but movies even more so. But I did watch it. I watched it in its entirety, probably because it did carry my attention enough. But as far as what actually took place with it, because I was following it all the while, when it actually did happen, there was nothing really new about it, you know, as far as that concerned. But there were some points that I thought was significant. But then again, I would say in reality, there are some aspects of the movies that the real life people probably wouldn't want the public to know. You know, if you were sexually molested while you were in prison, you probably wouldn't want too many people to know about that. And so, you know, I mean, that's just one example. But anyway, that's my opinion about the movie in itself. Last but not least, down here in South Florida, the case where the black male social worker that was shot, and he had his hands up, laying on his back, assisting a patient. They convicted the enforcement official, but if it runs quite consistent, most of the enforcement officials that are convicted of crimes are non-white people, and this was certainly the case also, where this non-white male, non-white, non-black male enforcement official discharged his weapon, and actually he was aiming at the patient and hit the black male that was laying on his back with his hands up. If anybody didn't know about it, you probably, because just off of how I'm describing it, you probably can see it on YouTube. North Miami Beach law enforcement. The area, the majority of the people in the area are non-white black people. Primarily is a large Haitian population from the Overfield, from the area south of that area, that have gained enough income to be able to purchase homes. They have moved in, out in the area, and they basically are dominating the political structure in that area. Matter of fact, the police chief was a black male from Haiti, I believe, and he got in some trouble earlier with that particular incident. He may have been fired, if I'm not mistaken, but he did get in some kind of trouble about it. But anyway, the non-white male enforcement official was convicted for that particular offense, something along the terms of negligence. They actually lowered the crimes that he committed, and it came down to something like negligence. But that's all I have to report. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Thank you for the assistance again. That is another pattern. That's something that we should all be alert to. These patterns where if it's going to be a non-white person, a non-white enforcement official especially, where they're going to seem like, oh, we're not going to allow any corruption from those who wear the shield. Our enforcement officials, we're not going to allow them out here and just act like they're, what they say, above the law. It will often be someone who is non-white who's being prosecuted. I think that's been a lot of the more high-profile cases in the state of Florida. It's been non-white officers that have been getting convicted or some sort of disciplinary problems. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, if we missed you totally.
Hello, ma'am. Be heard.
Yes, ma'am. Greetings, Irie. Good to hear from you.
Hello, everyone, and hi, Gus. I'm kind of having a bad evening. I've been trying all week to get people that have told me, non-white people that told me they have all these different, you know, people they know and groups for young men that could, you know, aid in do, teaching some constructive things to my son, and it, I feel like I've been people, you know, when it's just not serious about certain things as non-white, as a collective right now, and it's kind of disappointing. And I could really use that help right now. So there's that. I was talking to a friend in Illinois where I used to live, right after the after Katrina, and he was telling me that North Chicago, which is a very impoverished, obviously impoverished area, in the northern suburbs of Chicago, they pay more in property tax to their, you know, city corporations than do the residents of Lake Forest, which is one of the more wealthy areas of Illinois. And as a matter of fact, even real estate, one of his friends was going to look at some properties to see if there was potential for investment. And the police officers saw him and told him, "We don't want you here." So, Sundown Town report. As far as the Central Park Five movie, before school was out, I taught a drama class, and I told the sixth graders that were, well, not the sixth graders, they were eighth grade. I told them to watch just the first part, because I told them, I said, what I want you all to understand while you're out this summer is that things happen fast. Things can go bad very quickly. And this is a drama class. I said, I want you to know that drama can be used and acting can be used constructively and for, you know, fun purposes, but it can also change your life. And there are some people that lie so well, they act so well, they'll convince you to say you did something you didn't do. And I need you to watch that and be mindful of it from now on and understand that you have to tell the truth. Dedicate yourself to telling the truth no matter what, even when it seems like you might even die, because that's better than taking the blame for something that is not yours. My codification class is tomorrow, and I actually had a chance to talk with Mr. Fuller about it and ask him what was the best procedure for, you know, administrating the discussion. And, of course, you referred me to the code, page 171, asking the four questions: what do we want to do, why, how, and what do I expect the constructive result to be, and ask that of people that attend, and also ask them what their experiences are as far as life, and then try to, you know, ask them questions that ultimately take them back to the problem, racism, white supremacy. And I'm also teaching this class with a woman who is an astronomer. She went to school for this graduate school, but she studies the comedic mysteries, and she's teaching on all the gods and goddesses, meditation through, you know, comedic spirituality, which I'm very fortunate I met this lady because we were going over some of the goddesses, and one is a black cat named Bastet, and Bastet is the destructor of chaos. And then it clicked in my head. I said, oh, no wonder they went around saying black cats are bad luck, because it's quite the contrary. And let's see. The last thing I want to say is I did go to a meetup event hosted by a white male that is in a tragic arrangement. And it's about ending racism, white people ending racism. So before the end of it, I asked, there were three people there, one non-white Asian lady that is mixed with white, whose mother lied to her about being Asian. She said her mother did not tell her that her father was Malaysian until she was about 16. And I asked her if her mother was racist. She said, no, I don't think so. And then there was another white male there that admitted that he is on public aid. He has subsidized housing through HUD. He has Medicaid and also receives Social Security. So I asked the question, I said, what are you all willing to give up in order to put a complete end to racism, white supremacy? And he said, listen, I see people all around my building, and they're black. And I know that the only reason they're homeless is because they don't have the same benefits that I do, for whatever reason. And I want racism to end, but am I going to give up my benefits? I don't think so. So with that said, I would like to inquire with the audience, with his mentality. Imagine asking that, or the question being posed to the millionaires and billionaires or a powerful class of white people that are racist, white supremacists, and ask yourself, if this man who gets a paltry sum compares to them won't give up that, do we really think that they're willing to give it up? And if not, then we really have to work diligently and constructively to be codified in our thought, speech, and action in order for the system to end. And thank you. And that's all. Thank you, Gus. And thank you, everybody that is on the line.
Wow. That is amazing. Wow. I'm so glad that you had the opportunity to ask questions. That's why I said try to take advantage of it. They're having, you know, these meetings, some white author or professor or whoever it is, individual classified as white. They're going to be holding a meeting for Juneteenth or whatever. And they're going to talk about white supremacy, racism. That can be an opportunity to practice asking questions, practice your counter-racist codification. And I always think that is tremendously important, constructive, when you can question someone classified as white publicly in front of other non-white people. A lot of times that can be very helpful for them to process logic and even to inspire them to build up the courage to question other white people, question them publicly, to not just accept what they have to say, just because we're presented with someone white who says, oh, yeah, racism is a problem. And, you know, whatever it is, ask them some questions. Let's see, you know, how honest they are willing to be, how much truth they are willing to share. I'm sad to hear about the resources, trying to get resources for your offspring. Being an attempted parent in this system is extraordinarily challenging. I don't have children. That is one of the reasons. I know you're in the Louisiana area. If we have any listeners, if you are close to the region or know of resources that might be helpful, parent looking for resources for her child, you can drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, and I can pass the information along. But I can grasp that can be challenging. That is also by design. Other folks who dialed in, if we've missed you totally, proceed.
Bobby Hurd?
Yes, ma'am.
I don't know if it's my line or not, but it seems real distorted. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you. We can hear you clearly.
Okay. Thank you for allowing me to share. Definitely appreciate the clips. I am starting to or trying to pay better attention to when victims are asked, especially victims of racism, if they are victims of a crime, if they are asked, how do they feel about the victimizer, what should be done? I know, like, especially when I watch a lot of documentaries, it only seems like the victims say that, well, basically either something religious, as far as, you know, vengeance, that, you know, they're not supposed to take vengeance or things of that nature. And the same, but then also if there are also white victims, when I mentioned before, when I watched a documentary about the white man, the racist serial killer who was mainly targeting black males in Louisiana before and around a little bit after the time of Katrina, the white men that he killed, their family, one of the families, they were very adamant. The white women, they were like, no, we definitely agree that he should get the death penalty. And they were upset that he didn't. So, and I've seen that as a pattern. And even I think in Toronto had mentioned something as far as with serial killers, and just watching a number of different documentaries about serial killers, the one that definitely I remember very vividly is the documentary about Ted Bundy. And there were white crowds outside of the prison when he was getting executed. They were counting down, they were singing songs, almost like parodies to children's songs, selling t-shirts, things of that nature. So it's like it's all right for racists to want to take this vengeance, but even like on a very personal reason, and not just talking about 9/11 or anything of that nature, but it's all right for them, but it's never all right for us. I did finish the book, the audio book of The Queen, and it definitely reminds me of how Mr. Lowen in his Sundowntown book. He is very boastful. And I thought the same thing of this, of Josh Levin's book. He seems to have a lot of detail about the white men involved in the case regarding Linda Taylor. Her born name was Martha White, and he didn't actually even get to, contrary to the interview that we had listened to a few weeks back, he didn't even get to her upbringing until the 13th chapter, and there's only 18 chapters in the book. So I definitely thought that that was an act of racism, because he wrote at length about George Bliss, which was a newspaper reporter, and talked about how he got awards, but I think he got a few Pulitzer Prize awards or what have you. But then he also briefly mentioned that this man was not even editing his articles correctly and had misspelled words, and then had also inflated some of the facts about Linda Taylor. But I didn't even think that the book was in chronological order, because he basically starts off with Linda Taylor's crime regarding the welfare benefits fraud. And then he finally goes to, like, in the 13th chapter, he finally talks about the crime that she, well, not the crime, but her claim that she was the daughter of a non-white black male who was like a policy king, which is, from my understanding, it seems like it was the lottery. And at least that's when he was finally willing, or whatever, Josh Levin, to start to talk about Linda Taylor's upbringing and how she was abandoned by her mother, and they and her family basically hid the fact that she had a non-white father. So, and that was the whole reason why he at least brought up that, but that was in the 1960s, and then her welfare crimes didn't take place until the 1970s, and not even really giving Linda Taylor any sympathy, because it seemed like, at least from what I understood, she might have had really bad psychological problems, especially with her being abandoned and then her going on to abandon basically some of her children, especially the one that was had more melanin than the other two children, because if I'm not mistaken, she had three. But that's just like my brief overview. It did have some information in it, and it did also speak about some other books. There was one book that I was intrigued by, which is by a black male author called Chicago's New Negroes, and it explains policy a little bit better. I haven't read it yet, but they kind of briefly talked about it, because there's a there was a podcast about the Queen book, and just the brief synopsis of that was he basically talks about how the Italians, when they came into New York, they violently took over the policy industry, which was something that black people have ran. So it's just another, you know, another example of how white people, they will do things violently, not under any guise of, you know, business or religion or anything of that nature. And I'll meet my line. Thank you.
What was not Queen? What was the other book you said that was recommended? Chicago's New Negroes. Is that it?
Yes.
Okay. Groovy. I will check that out. Reading is more important than watching television. Always grand to get new book suggestions. I think we were talking about Queen some time ago. So right on to hear some of the listeners picking up books that are referenced. Let's see. So I got Chicago's New Negroes, Modernity, The Great Migration, and Black Urban Life by Devarian L. Baldwin. That's the one I found. I'll post a link for it. It looks like it is constructive and worth a read. Oh, it looks like this is kind of a newer book. That's what it looks like. Wow. Newer book. Always on the lookout. I'll check this one out and share if anyone else has thoughts. If we have folks that we missed totally, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Thomas in New York. Good to hear from you, sir.
Good to hear from you as well, Gus. Greetings to all the callers. A few things I wanted to say. To the question asked earlier, I don't think white power attracts black people to white people in the respect of just because they have power. I believe that we're attracted to white people because of white propaganda. None greater than most black people pray to a white god whose image has pictures and sculptures everywhere depicting him as a white man. And he was perfect according to their standards. So the white standard for beauty in the media, almost every product sold, especially luxury products, beauty products, has a white person as the model overwhelmingly and mostly every commercial magazine for years. I mean, in fact, over my lifetime, we got the first black Playboy model, the first black this, the first. The standards of beauty through white propaganda is always a white woman of a certain desire that white men have for her, or a white man with a certain desire that white women have for them, Brad Pitt, whomever. I don't think black women are wearing long blonde wigs and weaves because they're attracted to white power. You know, they've fallen for the, as Pam would say, the beauty con game, they're corrupted by the standards of white beauty that their media puts out there. It constantly bombards those images in our face on every magazine cover, on every television, and it's that their power that gives them the ability to do that. But I don't think that that's what we're attracted to. We're attracted to that as the standard of beauty. Forgiving white people is, in my opinion, not a self-respecting behavior. I wish we could go back to this event of Charleston, at the Mother Emanuel Church. And I wish we could change what happened first, but if we could go back and every black person did not forgive the next day or ever and were adamant about wanting retribution, wanting to see this man put to death, that was all they said. I would like to see how they would write about these people today. I bet you they wouldn't be talking about them in such a highlight. Keep hammering home, reinforcing in our mind that they forgave these people, keep showing those images. Reparations. In some respects, Mitch McConnell, white supremacist, he was right. How could you determine who should get them, especially if reparations is for slavery? There'll be a lot of white people getting reparations too. You have the whole reparations talk. It's only in the forefront right now because of this ADOS political movement. And it's a political and a LGBT movement. And it was designed to use racism as a political tool. It wasn't around 8 years during the black president at all. You didn't hear nothing about this. Now that we have this racist Trump in office, we went from 8 years of watching black people get murdered by the police and Zimmerman, and black women getting raped by Holsaw, and, people saying Black Lives Matter and walking around with their hands up in the air like they're surrendering, taking a knee, saying they can't breathe, to now all this aggressive talk toward reparations. Like, where did this come from? You know, you could almost see the what you would call a psyop in place. And they're not going to give us any reparations. I mean, that they're not changing the behaviors that's causing the problem. They're still slaves right now. Go to any prison. They're not changing their behaviors, so why would you think they're going to pay us for the behaviors they're still engaging in? It makes no sense. It's to me a waste of time. Gus, on NPR's website, they had an article entitled Roots of Housing Discrimination in Tucson. And they actually had one of the rules, the laws as it regarded to who they vented to. And very interesting, the cutoff in my copy here. But if you go to that website, NPR.com, Roots of Housing Discrimination in Tucson, June 20th, 2019, you can read it. Man, I should have hit the PDF button. It would have came out in PDF form. But it's very specific about not renting any property to black people. And it was funny, the article before there is, no one can't mess with anyone's cattle, pigs, dogs, cats, alligators, you know, coons, you know how that goes, everything they need. But then they got to the next line, you know, any black people, you know, I don't care if they're African or Asiatic descent, you know, it was very specific on cannot rent to those people at all. Don't want them in our neighborhood, Tucson, Arizona, home of great state of John McCain, that white supremacist. Gus, are you familiar with this thing called HEME? H-E-M-E.
No, sir.
Okay, because I know that you've been practicing veganism or vegetarianism. I don't know the proper name to call it. But, you know, you don't eat meat anymore, and you don't drink dairy products or any products that come from any animals. I've been at the exchange, this stock called Beyond Meat. I spoke about this company. It's jumped up to almost 700% increase in its stock value since 2 months ago when it became available. It's the highest performing stock, about to hit one of the highest performing stocks of all time. And I've just been looking at it. So they have this other company that's about to hit the market and be their competitor called Impossible Foods. And they have something called the Impossible Burger. And so, I see Burger King has it. McDonald's is testing it out. Little Caesars. KFC is trying to get some Impossible Chicken. Carl's Jr., Cheesecake Factory, Hard Rock Cafe, White Castle's, Beer Burger, Shake Shack, Qdoba, Del Taco, Taco Bell, they're all trying to test out products with this fake meat. And what it has in it is this thing called heme. So when I saw this thing heme, it strictly brought me right to the hospital because the synthetic blood, the same stuff that was in the book we read by Harriet Washington, they would give black people this synthetic blood. It always had heme in front of it. It's yellow. And what they've done with these burgers is they found a plant that has this heme inside of the roots. It's a GMO-grown soy plant, and they can extract the heme. What heme does is it gives, a hemoglobin. So when you eat meat, you cook it, you know, the blood cooks and the meat gets brown and, you know, you taste the taste of the dry blood. So that gives this burger that same taste. So when you put it on your taste bud, your body starts to secrete the chemicals that's saying, okay, your taste bud is saying you got meat. So, you know, instantly your body starts to secrete the chemicals needed to digest meat. And then it's a plant-based burger, so when it gets down here, those chemicals stay in you. So it just got approved by the FDA 2 years ago after about 30 years of being denied. And they gave it like a rating, like, you know, pretty much, yeah, we'll pass it, but we're not standing behind this rating type of rating. And it's very interesting that it's inside of these Impossible Burgers and soon to be inside of a lot of this vegetarian food. So I just wanted you to look into that because I know that you're eating that, and I just wanted to inform the family about it. And I'll meet my line. Thank you, guys.
Much obliged. Well, I will say this is not something that Gus eats. I think this is when Dr. Latham, when she was on the program, and she and others talked about getting away from processed foods, that they will have a lot of vegan foods that are vegan, that they don't, you know, have any, no cow, no animal products, no dairy products, all plant-based. But it'll be something like this that has been concocted and is very processed. While you still want to good, better, best would be, nope, I'm good on the Impossible Burgers, anything, because these are places that I wouldn't eat at to begin with. Chipotle or wherever else, Pizza Hut, any of these other franchises, if they're trying to incorporate this into their menu, what they're offering, I wouldn't eat that anyway. I think we had Walter Beach, his son was on the program about a week last week, and he lives here in Seattle, and he said that he got one of the Beyond Meat burgers, the plant-based, what Thomas in New York is talking about, but he said that's not something that I would eat on a regular basis. I would be wanting to eat fresh vegetables, fruits, nuts, beans, foods that have not been processed. Yes, they have all of that, the fake bacon, and they'll probably have fake chitlins and everything else, fake Cheetos and all of that. And, you know, some of that might be helpful in transitioning, but that's not what I would recommend be a staple of folks' diet. That is not a staple of my diet. I can be, what did I eat today? I had Ripple, that is pea-based milk, plant-based non-dairy milk substitute, and granola. Vegan granola, that's all I've eaten today. I didn't eat a whole lot. It's still early here. It's before, it's not quite 8:30 yet, so I'll probably eat something small before I go to bed. Oh, I had fruit too. I had an apple and a banana. I had fruit, sorry. But yeah, just not eating that sort of thing. Whites will make lots of money. I think Thomas in New York mentioned the stock price. They will make lots and lots of money promoting this, all these expensive products to make it really elitist. And for individuals classified as white, you do not have to be able, you do not have to afford or spend all that money on all these fake products. You can get regular fruits, vegetables, beans, and eat really healthy. Take much better care of yourself. Leave the Cheetos alone. And you can leave the fake meat stuff alone as well if you want to try it out, taste it, or whatever. But that's not something that should be a staple. Less processed. Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Other folks, if we missed you totally, let me give out the number again. 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks, we must totally proceed.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am. Good to hear from you.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Hope everyone's having the best evening they can. Thank you for the update on the Flint. I think I read that online about how they weren't going to pursue charges or something. And then the other caller talked about Chicago. Newark has been talked about for a long time. And I just want to connect this to, I guess, white women in education, like you talked about before. Because I'm thinking if the water was having all these problems, how did that affect the science experiments and classes? Because a lot of times science experiments, you have water, you at least use the tap water there to wash the tools that you use and things like that. And how they would affect them, and if they're not affecting them, are your schools having science experiments and things like that? I know that seems kind of, that may seem kind of far-fetched, but, you know, if we don't have clean, you know, I think that's something that we picked up on, and the teachers were like, well, why aren't these experiments working out? I've done these for years, I've taught these, and why are they weird now? What are the weird effects, and how these schools with government funds could be solving their own problems just by paying attention to what's going on in science experiments. I don't know why I thought about that, but it just kind of seems to make sense to me. Also, I know there were colleges in these areas that also should have science departments with basic science experiments. And, you know, just to think, well, if this is not going on, what else is not going on in the schools? Just something else to think about. And that's all I have for now. Thank you.
Much obliged. Appreciate that, Dr. Welsing, counter-racist scientist. Definitely appreciate thinking in that way. Other folks that we have missed totally, if you have commentary, questions you would like to share, proceed. Oh, did we nab everybody, or at least didn't miss anybody? Anybody that has a hand up that we missed? Wait a minute. Sorry. Other folks that we missed totally? Other folks that have a hand up that we missed totally?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Greetings, Imhan DC. Good to hear from you.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Good to hear from you, or good to hear from you also. Greetings. I wanted to say, with Thomas in New York's comments about meat and this fake meat, just like when I eat meat, I can taste blood. I can always taste the blood. It doesn't matter how well cooked it is. I taste the blood just as if I taste blood from my tongue when I bite it. I always taste the blood, and it's not a good taste. But I did eat meat while I've been here, or have been eating some meat, and I also got a chance to kill a chicken or a rooster and eat that. And a warrior has to, well, I'll just say, if you're going to eat meat, you shouldn't eat meat, but if you're going to eat meat, you should kill it and eat it. You should kill it so that you see what the process is, so you can see that animal struggling. You can see that animal begging for life, and you kill it, and then you eat that. That's what people should do if they're going to eat meat. It's not a very pleasant thing to do, and the meat isn't as pleasing to me anyway after I've killed it. It makes me not want to eat meat, but I did it for reasons of my own. And I wanted to also say, again with Thomas, I had mentioned to him, I was joking, but I had mentioned to him that if we had a international Millie Wapathon, that it would heat up our bodies, thus heating up the earth, and also like radiating energy from our body that would end up being very negative and killing white people. Thomas didn't laugh at it. He didn't think it was a very funny joke. I don't think so. But my point is that white people die from also our bodies, which I didn't get that for myself. I've heard some black scientists mention that the radiation from our bodies is actually also killing white people. I sent, Mr. Gus, I sent you an article about heat waves. I wanted to read the first paragraph of one of these articles. Okay, let me see. It says, tens of thousands of people in the U.S. will die annually due to scorching heat waves if global temperatures rise 3 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Okay, they're talking about albinos. Black people will die too. Some, you know, because yeah, but you need to, if you exercise, you have a less chance of dying once the heat rises to a certain temperature. With these albinos, these white people, the light and heat, very similar thing. When it hits their skin, it doesn't get absorbed, and because of that, it burns their skin. However, some heat does get absorbed. The heat that gets absorbed and goes into their body then doesn't get absorbed by their organs, at least not properly. It doesn't get absorbed at a high enough rate. And what happens is the heat reflects off of their organs inside their body, cooking their organs, making them infertile, and ultimately killing them. There's been some heat waves that recently I think it was last week. Last week, there was a heat wave that went through Europe and India. And in India, it killed, a few hundred people or something, and maybe 100 people, reports said. But in 2003, I mentioned before, there was a heat wave that went through Europe and killed over 70,000 people, according to the reports, white people. So what I'm trying to say, heat will solve a lot of problems. I think heat will ultimately solve our problems. I could be incorrect. And it's not like we should just wait and see what, quote unquote, Mother Nature does. That's all. Thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan DC. Other folks who dialed in, I'll look for that article as well. Thank you for letting me know. Other folks who dialed in, if we have missed you totally, please dial in. Do not wait till the last moment. If you have commentary to share, dial in. If you have commentary.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Draptomania.
Greetings, Gus, and callers. I wanted to respond about the 1ACS. I finished watching the documentary yesterday. I did find it very informative because I didn't. I heard about it. I was, pretty young during that time. And I did hear about the case, but I didn't know all of the details. I mean, it was somewhat, I didn't remember all of the details because it had been so long ago. So I did find it to be informative. It did make me upset to see how, when I see victims of white supremacy being mistreated, it always bothers me. You know, I always get, very, sensitive, or I do feel the pain of other victims when I see us being harassed and mistreated. So it did, I was going through some emotions in regards to that, and just the fact that how young they were and how they were being mistreated by these cops and lawyers and things like that. But after the documentary, they did have Oprah show where all of the actors and the exonerated five came on, and there was one of the characters, well, one of the victims, he had an issue with his father because his father made him say that these things happen, but the father, because he was being coerced by the police officers. And, being that I'm able to look at things from an analytical perspective and with a codified perspective now, I did have a lot of empathy for this victim, who was his father, that talked him into, saying that he did the rape when he didn't, because the father was also a victim and he was being threatened by the police to say, tell him to tell his son to admit to that crime. But the sad thing is, the callers, and you were talking about how forgiveness and how victims tend to, we tend to always forgive the racist, white supremacist suspects. We don't have any issue with forgiving them. Not all of us, but a lot of us are programmed and conditioned to forgive. For example, with the Dylan case. But this gentleman, he was on the show, and he was talking about how he hates his father, and that he thinks he's a coward. And I felt like that was exploitive. I felt like it was anti-black. I mean, I can understand, he has VGQ. That was his experience. But I did feel like it kind of came to mind, like when you talk about how, I think the other caller was talking about, like, when we have pain or trauma, how when we discuss our trauma and we've gone through trauma, that these suspects put us through, they like to rehash the drama. They want to know how we felt. They want to see it. They want to re-experience it. And it gave me a very uneasy feeling, and it made me see, like, you know, we will forgive them, but when it comes down to our own family members, or when we're going through stuff with our own family members, because of the conditioning and the anti-blackness, we have issues with forgiving each other and ourselves. And I just found it to be very, very sad and unfortunate that this victim, you know, came on that show and he said what he said. But, I mean, I can understand. And he, like I said, he has VGQ. I also wanted to just report and also say that when we discuss on your shows how white people, suspects, how they have, they communicate with each other, and they talk and they do unjust networking. I had an incident with the house yesterday, you know, with the situation I've been going through with this terrorism here in my living situation. So one of the things that these suspects do, they will pretend like they're trying to help you, like they're trying. We was talking about that yesterday on workplace racism. They will act as if they're trying to be helpful and useful to you, but really, and it's really just it's just a facade. You know, they're still behind the scenes. It's not like they're not practicing white supremacy. They're just, you know, putting a facade to make you think that they are really trying to help you. But then in the back end, what it is, they're networking with the ones that you're maybe complaining about, that you're going to them to try to seek help and assistance, but really they're not. They're still doing, like you say, I know this is a metaphor, but you use this on your program all the time, the Voltron effect, how they will come together. So my case in point was the experience one of the housemates, they seen her come out the house. So they asked her how everything was going, and she was telling them that, you know, she hasn't been here. She's in house sitting. So they say to her, I guess they try to tell her about what was going on. So and I was in the kitchen while she was on the porch talking to them. So I guess she was trying to give them a signal that I was there, or, you know, I really wouldn't put it past them that they knew I was there and wanted me to hear it just to see the reaction. I'm just don't put anything past, you know, these terrorists. So she says to them, that, I get the info on everything, something to that degree. And, I hear about everything. I get the inside scoop on everything. And I said to myself, just like I thought, you know what I mean? Even though you're not here and you're acting like you're here to support me and you're reporting this person also that's terrorizing me, in reality, they've been networking the whole time. You know, so it was just a validating experience for me to see how they do this. And it's not anything new or surprising. It was just like, okay, the validation, here we go. Everything that we discuss on this show about how they will talk and how they stick together, and that's just the way they are. So one of the things that Dr. DeGruy said while she was on your show, and it stood out to me and it was very profound. She said that no matter how perfect you become, they will get worse. So, you know, like, we can just be who we are and do the best we can under this system, because no matter what we do, how much we try, they're always going to have, they're going to be who they are anyway. And that's all I have to share. And thanks for listening. Thanks for taking my call.
Much obliged, Draftomania. Other folks who dialed in that we have missed totally, if you have commentary to share, proceed. Don't wait till the last minute.
Hello, Gus. May I add something really quick?
I was going to try to see if we were missing anyone, but since they're lollygagging, proceed. Oh.
Okay, thank you. I wanted just really quick to say that the meat situations, the meat alternatives, it reminds me of how there were all of a sudden natural hair products geared to natural, you know, black women, when they kind of caught on that not only were we rejecting, you know, traditional hair care systems, but then I'm pretty sure because of the internet having more capabilities, this was around like 2008, 2009, people were sharing recipes on how to do their own conditioners and shampoos, and then all of a sudden L'Oreal bought a company by a non-white so-called Middle Eastern man that was for natural hair, and it's called As I Am. And then after that, I just saw an upspring of more natural hair products. So it's kind of the same thing. It's a wave. And, you know, the white supremacists that practice racism through capitalism, they're just trying to, you know, capitalize. And also with, I believe it was Thomas in New York saying that non-white women don't wear weave because they're attracted to white power. I think he's correct, and I think what you surmised is correct. It's basically relative, because my understanding about a human being is that we try to do the things that ensure our survival. And in the conditions we live in, that means for some victims of racism, hey, I'm going to wear my hair a certain way because it's going to make my life easier on the job, at school, or if it means, or like the young lady on Sundown Town, she was talking about her mom living in an all-white city and, you know, just trying to blend in and conform. And it could be also be, hey, I want to marry a white woman or a white man. I want my children to look mixed or not, you know, as non-white as possible. It's all us trying to survive under the conditions of racism and white supremacy. So I don't think anybody, I think both of you are correct. Thank you.
Much obliged. Did we miss anybody? Anybody that we have totally missed out on hearing from who had commentary to share? Anybody that we missed totally? Anybody that we missed totally? Grant, I assume we got everybody. Any extra comments folks had that we want to make sure that they get in before we get ready to conclude?
John Derrick?
Yes, sir. Henry in Chicago.
In regards to the caller, Irie, when she was mentioning about her friend that lives in North Chicago, a city that is poor, there was a report a couple of years ago, not too long ago, where the Cook County assessor at the time, Joe Berrios, who is a white Hispanic, was overpricing areas where there were low income and black neighborhoods, and cutting the property taxes for the rich areas, and particularly white areas within the Cook County area. So That's probably why her friend is paying a lot of taxes in a poor area, because of the fact that this race soldier drove up the prices for property tax in the poor neighborhoods. So I just wanted to add that.
Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. Glad to hear that as well. Lots of tricks. I said that for years. Whites have developed and refined their techniques for stealing property from black people worldwide. They had that segment about what's going on in South Africa, where they talk about truth and reconciliation all the time. Land, still a problem, still controlled by individuals who classified as white.
Gus, I just wanted to, I'm sorry, Gus. I just wanted to say that I just got finished listening to the archives with Thomas Shapiro and his book, and you guys were discussing black wealth with white people and housing situations, and it was a very good show. I just got finished watching it today. I mean, listening to it today.
2009, Mr. Shapiro, The Hidden Cost of Being African American. Other folks we missed totally. If you have commentary to share, proceed.
Oh, you said,
yes, sorry.
Go ahead.
No, you go, sir.
Thank you, sir. I was just going to give suggestions on two potential books based on two different personalities that maybe if we're going to pick a personality for the next book reading, or you know, in the near future, Paul Robeson and Sam Cooke. For specific reasons, Sam Cooke is his all through his professional career, he attempted to have control over his businesses, and also he was very much involved into the attempt to solve the problem of racism, white supremacy, through his talent and his business interests. Paul Robeson, from my understanding, it was so much more than just an actor, singer, and football player to the world of non-white black people attempting to solve the problem of race and white supremacy. And I think that would be an interesting book. I don't know any names of book, but I'm pretty sure there are several books on the two personalities. I just have to look it up myself and find out on to give you names of the books. But those two personalities, I think we should study also, Sam Cooke and Paul Robeson. Thank you.
I think Mr. Beast just gave out a book on Paul Robeson while he was here last week. There was someone who spoke up simultaneously. Yes. Make sure if anybody that has not shared at all, you should speak now. Anybody that we missed totally. Any person that we missed totally have commentary, or did we get everybody? Grand. I will assume that we got everybody. Any other folks? I know someone spoke up. I think it was Thomas in New York. Did you have another comment, Thomas in New York?
Yes, I did. I don't know if I mentioned this last week, but about the Central Park jogger case. The gentleman who committed the crimes and admitted to them, I don't know if I should call him a gentleman, he would rape women and then give them the option of keeping their life, or he'll cut their eyes out. And he wanted to be the last thing they saw, and, you know, never forget him, I guess. you know, the psychological profile plays out in my mind to be. Either way, he admitted to that crime and I think four others, which got those people, the five young men exonerated. However, he never got a day added to his sentence because of that, because of the statutes of limitations. So essentially, they did all that time for a crime he committed, and he gets no time added to his sentence, even though he was doing 33 years, and they said they would never allow him to get out. They'll, you know, violate his rights, I guess. But I just thought that was very interesting. I did find the writing in the article, it says, no lot shall be sold, conveyed, rented, or leased in whole or part to any person of African or Asiatic descent, or to any person not of white or Caucasian race. No lot shall be used, occupied, or permitted to be used or occupied in whole or in part by any person of African or Asiatic descent, or by any person not of the white or Caucasian race, except such persons as may be employed therein in domestic servants by the owners and tenants of any lot, as therefore. And that's written into the law in Tucson, Arizona, in a certain area. And I would say that is white supremacy and white power right there. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
I found that report about the white terrorism in Tucson with the housing. I shared it a little while ago. Folks that follow me, at Until Justice, at Until Justice, I shared the report. Much obliged. And it has the PDF that he talked about. You can get all the wonderful details right in line with Sundown Towns. We're finishing it up next Thursday. Anybody else have commentary if we missed you, or anyone have a hand up that wanted to chat before we get ready to conclude?
Hi, Jack.
Can I be?
I heard B in Toronto. We'll get you first, and then I heard the male caller as well. B in Toronto?
Sure. I'll say this really quickly. Thank you. The other thing that I had noticed, going back to the forgiveness phenomenon, I would more so interpret as coercive forgiveness, because if the victims of the Charleston church shooting were to say otherwise, they would have been accused of inciting a riot or dividing the nation or whatever other smear campaign that white supremacists would come up with. But the other thing that I wanted to find out was, are the parishioners any safer today than they were approximately 4 years ago? Because my concern is that in the quickness to forgive, that absolved the government to a certain degree of providing the appropriate protections, such as providing funding for protective equipment, such as metal detectors or cameras, security cameras, security, because this was based on a hate crime, that could, if the churches collaborate together, mainly the Black churches collaborate together, can also use to protect their parishioners. The same with other organizations that are affected by the hate crime as well. So I think that it was also a missed opportunity to call upon the government to provide the appropriate protections and compensation, similar to how the Jewish Anti-Defamation League are easily able to get funding on hate crime. I know that it would not be so easy for the Black community, considering the climate and the designation and the caste system, and their willingness to withhold the resources. But it was just a thought that I wanted to share. Thank you. I'll leave the line.
Much obliged. Great point. Be in Toronto. Let's see. I think that was Imhan DC. Was that you, sir? Did you have commentary?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Yes, sir. I wanted to say, so I'm still here in Ghana, and I got to meet Dr. Cambon while I was here, which was really awesome. I didn't even know he was going to be here. So that was awesome. That was a treat. The other thing I wanted to say was in regards to the heat waves. So the reason I mentioned before, of course, the reason why white people are doing those chemtrails is because, you know, they're dying from heat. They're doing the chemtrails in order to get water in the sky to absorb the heat. The heat waves that went through Europe just last week, they were also able, white people were able to get a heavy rain to follow the heat wave in order to knock out the heat, in order to mitigate the heat. The same thing with in East India, or in India, there was water or rain, heavy rainfall that mitigated the heat. And this is, you know, their engineering. And then it was North India, as in the most albino of the Indians that were dying, that I saw anyway. Maybe I'm wrong. Okay.
Much obliged, M. Hondisi. Travel safely. Glad you got to meet Dr. Cambon. The caller waiting till the last minute. That's why you will not get your 4-5. The caller is 0620-0620. Did you have a brief, like 30 seconds comment that you can get in?
Yes, Gus. I'm happy here.
Oh, yes, sir. We can hear you.
Okay, Gus. What I would like to add on to yesterday, you had a young lady called in about whether she should go to a meeting or not because her job might terminate her. But what I wanted to say right quick, that she should attend that meeting, because I went through a situation just like that years ago, and I didn't go to the meeting, and they put on there that I was terminated for threatening another employee, and that never happened. And what they did, it held up my unemployment for 6 or 7 months. So I wasn't getting no unemployment for 6 or 7 months based on the lie they told upon me, based on the lie they told on me. So she got to go to that meeting, because they could put on there any kind of lie against her. So she has to go to that meeting in order to get her unemployment. And that's all I have, Justin. Thanks for everything.
Oh, that's so appreciated. We had a female caller for workplace racism yesterday. That's Fridays, 5 p.m. Eastern. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. There we go. But she wrote in and she was saying, she called and she said that she had been giving a notice of dismissal for non-disciplinary reasons, and that they were giving her, she was on paid leave for a certain amount of time. And then at the end of her paid leave, she's supposed to have a meeting where she can present cause to not be terminated. And she said it, you know, it seems that they had already come to a conclusion about how they wanted to deal with the situation. And she was calling in to ask whether or not it would be worth the time and energy to even be present. And folks are saying she should go and even take the opportunity to ask some questions and to also contact the unemployment office herself to get information about her rights and what she's entitled to. But I think that's a great suggestion to know from personal experience as well, to just go however long it is, ask questions, learn, and then move forward so they have as little as possible to use against you. Thank you so much for calling in to share. And thanks to everyone who participated live and or in the archives. I hope it was worthy of your time and energy. That book, Thomas Shapiro, The Hidden Cost of Being African American. He has quite a few books, Thomas Shapiro, that are all basically on the same subject matter. But it's the same type of thing. White people are not ignorant about racism. And that's a big point in the book. Even the poor white people, they are not ignorant about what it means to be classified as white and all the resources that you get just from being classified as white and cool with other whites, racists. Your life, your access to power is substantial in comparison to non-white people. We'll conclude there. I'll post that broadcast where Dr. Welsing talked about forgiveness, because I thought that was so important. She spent about a good hour talking about it. That was like 2 months before the shooting in Charleston, South Carolina.
I'll double check, but I think it was very close and a little bit ahead of time, Dr. Welsing. With that, much obliged for everyone participating. Again, I hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Let's protect those brain computers so we can go about solving the problem. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. We are sober, buckled up, and not on the cell phone, doing all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in. Happy Juneteenth for those who are celebrating.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.